Welcome to Unspeakable, the podcast of the Cthulhu Mythos gaming magazine, The Unspeakable Oath. This is episode 19, hosted by Ross Payton of Slang Design and Roleplaying Public Radio, Scott Glancy of Pagan Publishing, and Shane Ivey of Arc Dream Publishing. Our guest today is Call of Cthulhu adventure and sourcebook author Brett Kramer. Brett edits the Lovecraft e-zine The Arkham Gazette and is a frequent contributor to The Unspeakable Oath. He also wrote the parts of the upcoming Masks of Nyarlathotep companion for 60 Stone Press. And Shane, do you want to talk about our sponsors?
Hi, everybody. So the sponsors are probably the same ones that we did last time, but Atlas Games from...
They bear repeating what was being sponsored.
They do. I think that might even be a rule. but Atlas published Where the Deep Things Are, and from Ken Height and a few other of his Lovecraftian horror for very young children books. And they're working with John Tynes and Greg Stolze, of course, on the upcoming new edition of Unknown Armies. And they recently did a new edition of Feng Shui. I think that was what threw Atlas, wasn't it? And among a ton of other awesome things. Yep. And so you can find them at atlasgames.com/Cthulhu4Kids.
Excellent. Let's see. We also got sponsors of Innsmouth Free Press. Let's not forget those guys. Mm-hmm. Publishers of Swords and Mythos, edited by Sylvia Moreno Garcia at InnsmouthFreePress.com.
I've read it. It's a really good book. It's got a lot of great stories in it. So I think I reviewed it in the previous episode of this or on RPPR. But anyways, it's really good.
And of course, shall we have Mr. Kramer sponsor do the announcement for his for his?
Yeah, I thought I only won one free episode, but I'll take a second.
There you
Arkham,
go.
Yeah, well, there's the Arkham Gazette, a magazine about Lovecraft Country for Call of Cthulhu, edited by me. And I guess technically it's published by Sentinel Hill Press, but that is also just me. So it's me all the way down.
Yeah, I have the same problem with Pagan Publishing. It's like, published by Pagan Publishing, as if there's a whole bunch of us.
Right. No. You have to keep up the facade, you know.
I see.
I can use the Royal We in emails.
Yeah.
I'm going to include my freelancers. Freelancers count as we. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so sentinelhill.wordpress.com. Sentinel Hill, all one word.
Sentinelhillpress.wordpress.com.
Yeah. Check the show notes.
Yeah.
Don't forget that.
There is a lot of presses. All right, so moving along to Mr. Ivy, Golden Goblin Press.
Absolutely. Oscar Rios's terrific Cthulhu Mythos publishing house. They have Island of Ignorance, Tales from the Crescent City, De Horror Cosmico for Roman times, and all kinds of great things. And they're at goldengoblinpress.com. And then, of course, the H.P. Lovecraft Film Festival, which the next one is coming up in April in Oregon, April 25th and 26th, and then another in San Pedro, California, May 1st through 3rd at 8plfilmfestival.com.
Yes, I believe Mr. Height will be in attendance in Oregon, as will I. So there will be undoubtedly enormous amounts of drinking mm-hmm. and complaining about how history didn't go the way we wanted it to.
are you doing, do they have, you know, panel discussions and things like
well,
that?
Well, the film festival has blown up into a sort of a Cthulhu con. And if I'm not mistaken, the one that's going on in April, let me just, run over here and check that. But I believe the one that's going on in April is actually the Cthulhu con. That is, there's less films and more stuff. More panels and things like that, yeah. but both of them have inflated over the years to have panel discussions by filmmakers, Lovecraft aficionados, and self-declared experts like myself, and genuine ones like Mr. Height. So it has vastly increased its breadth, I guess you'd say, from being merely just a film festival where you sit around in the dark, passively absorbing it, to sort of an interactive experience.
Yeah.
And it essentially, though, just it can't be missed. Check the show notes. We'll have all the exact pertinent details about the Oregon one, but I believe the one in April 25th and 26th is not the full film festival, but it is an expanded Cthulhu convention. So we'll see how that goes.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. So, Brett, yes. I don't remember. Have you contributed to some books for Golden Goblin? We just mentioned.
I have not. I pitched a scenario for their upcoming Caribbean collection that they politely pointed out would probably take four times the amount of space they had.
Yeah.
I may repurpose that. But no, I had some stuff in the Miskatonic River Press, which sort of preceded Golden Goblin, but not in the Golden Goblin book yet.
Gotcha.
Although I backed their Kickstarters. So.
Yeah, and why would you not? All right.
All right thinking cultists backed their Kickstarters.
Yes.
Well, they I got to give them credit. They actually deliver on time, so I think that puts them in a rare class.
Why are you telling me that?
Why would you bring that
why
up?
Why are you bringing that up?
Because there are like 4,000 Kickstarters that are late.
I still don't know why you're telling me this.
Well, you're not Chaosium, are you?
Oh,
but I'm Pagan Publishing, bitch. So
shots fired.
Let me assure you, I can delay. When we get to my announcements, we'll talk about all of my delays for my Kickstarter that's ongoing. But Mr. Ivy, you've got some announcements to make.
Yes. Yeah, let me try to run through everything pretty quickly here. So the new Oath, as with most of these episodes, the news is the same. The new Oath is more or less in the works. So Dan Harms and I are doing most of the work right now on reviewing selections, and my next job is to kind of review our scenario options and put one or two of them into active play testing to get notes on, and that's always the hardest. It seems like that's the hardest thing with the Oath is getting scenarios, because sort of building them to just the right size for the magazine is really tricky. In fact, I think our submission guidelines, I need to revise them, because I think I went with the original Oath idea of trying to make it no more than 5 or 10,000 words, and you know, which sounds great in theory, but it never happens. So
and then I turn in shit that's 30,000 words long, because
right,
that's
yeah.
how
we've
I
all
roll.
Been there.
Occasionally we get a 30,000 word scenario for the 20,000 word magazine. Yeah, but
hey, there were pre-generated characters. That totally is the reason it went over.
That's
to be fair, scenarios like Cold Dead Hand are worth going over. I mean, that is alone was a hell of a ride. And
yeah,
I know some of the people from the RPPR group are coming to run Cold Dead Hand, or wanting to run Cold Dead Hand for Arc Dream at Gen Con this year.
Yeah,
so.
That's great.
Yeah, it's a great. I mean, it's a great con. It's a perfect con scenario.
Well, let me assure you,
it has nuclear weapons, commandos, and monsters.
Well, I'm glad to hear that it finally found a home, because it was always kind of an orphan. All right, moving along, sir. It's Mr. Ivy's floor.
Oh, sorry. Okay, so other things, we've got like a dozen different things that are in various stages of undress. So Delta Green Extraordinary Renditions, the next fiction book, was the sort of second fiction book that was funded in the Kickstarter for Tales from Failed Anatomies.
I did turn in my work for that, right? You did get a short story out of me.
Yes. I've marked it up with red notes and need to send those over to you to make you sad. So I'm reviewing all the stories in that, and then we've got one or two stragglers to bring together.
And I'm not one of them.
But well, you were one of them, but not any longer. No.
Okay.
And then so we did a book called Elder Godlike, which was sort of our superhero game Godlike in the Cthulhu mythos, that sort of converted the way Godlike works over to basic role playing for the Octung Cthulhu game line for Modiphius. And so that's in layout and so forth now, and they're doing a Dave Bluer, who's worked with us a lot as well, is doing a Savage Worlds conversion. So we hope to see that in PDF in the next few weeks. I understand it's fairly imminent.
And speaking of someone who actually ran playtests of it at both for the RPPR group, and I ran a game of it at Gen Con last year. It's actually a really fun system. It's mostly Call of Cthulhu, mm-hmm. with the godlike superhero systems converted to a percentile system instead of the one roll engine. And I know at the Gen Con game, everyone had a lot of fun. It ended in a TPK, but they got to kill a lot of Nazis. So super Nazis. You know,
right?
So it was a good time.
Aren't all Nazis really super?
No. I mean, at least it is an ethos, but I mean, I don't think that qualifies.
But somebody's writing down the pull quotes from the episode is he thinks Nazis are super.
They're super to kill.
Right.
All right.
Fair. And then there's a role playing game based on Delta Green, which is something I heard of a while ago.
Tell us more of this Delta Green of which you speak.
All right. So we're doing the standalone role playing game for it, as everybody probably knows who's listened to any episodes of this, because every single episode over the last however many years we've been doing it, I say it's in development. So it's in development. And we've brought Ray Wininger aboard to help make things great.
Always a good plan.
Yeah, which I'm very, very happy with. He and Dennis are working closely together in their day jobs and have been for a while now. And of course Ray goes way back with just about everybody on the Delta Green team. So that's been very, very fun. And really, really nice news for me, because I like to have an additional sort of neutral set of eyes, especially on the rules stuff, which is where he's doing right now, because developing the rules for that has just been such a bear, because, you know, it's Greg and it's Dennis and it's me, and each of us kind of has a distinct approach to things, and yet we want to make sure that the rules are really coherent, you know, and kind of deliver
Ray, Ray's a great guy. Ray's a great guy for any number of reasons. Yeah. But one of them is he is a fellow who's made a career out in the real corporate world of being able to tell extremely powerful, wealthy people that they're doing it wrong and still keep his job.
Yeah. So he should have no problem with us, because we're not that.
Yeah, he can navigate that extremely well, where, you know, you'll show you where the mistakes are, and you'll even think it's your idea.
Right. So right now Ray has all the playtest reports from the second round of playtesting in his hands, and then we're going to review those and put them together and see if see if we can kind of make it gel or with what we have, or if we need to, if there may be things that get revised enough that we need to have another round of playtesting just to make sure. But I'm hoping not. I think we may be good. And of course that's for all the play. We're looking at two books for the core rules, because it's kind of a hefty monster. So that's for the sort of central book, the player's book that has all the main rules. And then there's going to be the GM's book that has all the Cthulhu mythos and the monsters and the magic, mm-hmm. and alien technology and all kinds of things for rebuilding those from the ground up and customizing them so that they're surprising and new, and you don't recognize, you know, a sand dweller the first time you run into it. And know exactly what can, you know, what's good against them and what's not. And also all the stuff about the sort of all the conspiracies that are in the setting and that the player characters interact with, and ways to build those and customize them as well to keep things spicy. So the depth of the GM's book is going to need its own fairly extensive play testing, because we're sort of reverse engineering a lot of things that Delta Green has always done in ways that you can kind of do them over from scratch. And so we need to make sure that we don't foul that up in our innovations. So that's cool.
I would also like to mention, sorry,
yeah,
that the some of you, if you're curious about these rules, and one thing that's sort of really, I guess, must be further constraining you is the fact that they're going to be backward compatible,
right,
with previous Delta Green material. So that kind of puts an extra complication on. But if you're eager to see these rules in a fairly polished form, Dennis Detwiller made a preview of the player rules on his Patreon. Did you see that?
I did.
Yeah. So you can take a look and see. I mean, it's like character. It's basic, like, skill rolls, and there's a little bit about, like, hypergeometry and unnatural monsters and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I haven't had time to go through it. Like,
all that stuff is GM rule stuff. So it makes. I haven't seen the document that he put up online, but it sounds like it's got kind of a hodgepodge. But if you look up Dennis Detwiller on Patreon, you can find his page, and he's put scenarios up and all kinds of things,
including one that connects to Masks of Nyarlathotep.
That's true.
All right, so let me see. I said I was going to do this quickly, and we an hour. So
you have 30 seconds to get through four more bullet points.
Okay, No Soul Left Behind is a big campaign from by Caleb Stokes and from Greg Stolze's game Better Angels, which is in going to layout now. I've just got the final illustrations for that, and the text is all ready to roll. So it's going to be really, really fun. We have the new edition of Puppet Land in an expanded hardback sort of storybook edition, which is going to be very pretty. Sam Araya is doing a bunch of color paintings for that. And his process has been really fascinating because he's, for a lot of the paintings, he's basically building his puppets by hand first and then using them as models for the painting so that he can sort of get the way that they hang together just right. And so I think he's going to be putting some photos of that work in progress online as we
can. Really, I can't think of anyone better than Araya to do that fucking horrible goddamn puppets.
Well, and it's nice because Sam, of course, most gamers know him from Unknown Armies and from his sort of horror work and White Wolf and so forth. But he's also has a really great touch with color when he does really colorful sort of fairy tale kind of paintings that's surprisingly effective. So it's turned out really nicely seeing him put material together for Puppet Land. And then we have a ton of fun of sketches by an artist named Holly Minger that's going to round the book out. And so it'll have new material from John Tynes, the author, and lots of little adventures by.
I think I've heard of this John Tynes guy. I expect good things from him.
Yeah. Ross is putting one or two together, and
I just sent those to you. Did you get them?
Ken Height, Jason Morningstar, Aaron Dimbo, and James Wallace, Matt Forbeck, Gareth Hanrahan. We've got lots of people putting neat material together for it. So, Fred Hicks, I think, is putting one or two together. It's going to be really, really fun with that together. So that's the illustration and the writing is sort of in progress on Puppet Land. So essentially, as soon as I have the Extraordinary Editions stories more or less out of my hands, then turning my attentions more directly to the new Delta Green game and whatever pieces of it are mine that still need to be handled. But and then we've also got other stuff that's coming up. I may have talked about some of this before, but we've got a card game called WrestleNomicon that Dennis and I developed a long time ago. That's just this very funny, goofy kind of, you know, like pro wrestling style fighting game between Cthulhu and Hester, and
that was where the card Sears Tower to the Crotch comes
from. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I don't remember whether that was Dennis's or mine, but yeah.
It's a winner no matter which way you cut it.
Right. So we've been so he's come up with some really interesting mechanics ideas for how that card game is going to play through. So we're going to be moving on that pretty soon. And Kurt Komoda is the artist who's working on that with us, and he did a ton of work for Better Angels and No Soul Left Behind, and he's got a really, really great kind of touch that, you know, he's very good at making things kind of over the top and funny and grody and creepy at the same time. So that's been fun. And then we've got other stuff in sort of a little further out. There's a big Delta Green card game that we've talked about a few times and that we're working on, that Greg and Dennis have been sort of hammering away at, and books about the King in Yellow, and which would have been really timely if we'd thought to do them, you know, 2 years ago before True Detective came out. And yeah,
everyone saw that coming,
right?
Yeah, everyone except Major us saw that, yeah, they were going to do. Totally going to have a King in Yellow thing on HBO. That was
right. Yep.
It's just it's a natural progression, you know, from Sopranos to that.
So lots of stuff going on, and all right. So that's my 30 seconds.
Okay.
So Scott, tell us what's happening over in Pagan Land.
Well, what's happening over in Pagan Land? Primarily what's happening over in Pagan Land is I'm handling all kinds of amazing domestic issues, like I'm losing Mr. John Crow. Mr. Crow, who's been a longtime Pagan contributor and writer, who's working with me on Horrors of War, has made the horrifying decision to get engaged with the plans to get married, and is moving out. So my roommate since 1990, or housemate, I should say, since 1998, is got himself a house.
Wow.
And I am helping him move into it. And let me just say, first of all, we will be losing enough cats that we will be downgraded from crazy cat lady, you know, to just merely cat fancier.
Okay.
Levels of cats in the house. We will be also losing enough of our arsenal that we'll be downgraded from terrorist cell to merely twitchy maniac. John's weapons will be leaving, and I am hoping that before they go, and before the cats go as well, I can snap some pictures of them. If I can find a way to pile his entire collection around me, like, you know, a bonfire around a heretic, that's kind of the look I'm hoping for.
Oh my God.
All the guns and all the cats in one big pot.
If I can do that, well, that's kind of perfection. I don't think we can get the cats stand still for it, but yeah, the giant pile of mostly antique firearms is leaving. John's the guy who has all the rolling block and falling block and lever action and bolt action iron from the last century, you know, from actually 2 centuries ago now, and World War One. That's his stuff. He's not a guy who ever collected, you know, oh, it's got a laser sight and it's got a polymer stock. He could care less. He wants something that was used to shoot at the Hun, you know, or maybe engines, or, you know, whoever the opponent du jour was. So we'll be losing John. That's been a huge thing. So taking up my time. So just let people know that there are Pagans out there who are still alive besides myself. other things that are happening. I finished another NPC for the Delta Green game. I'll be sending that off to Shane. All I have to do is, let's see, 8 more of them. And that's one section down.
Who is it that you're about to send over?
As far as who our NPC who's just gotten done, who's going to be turned in, is let's see here. It's an update of Agent Curtis McCrae, who was Agent Cyrus back in the day, and now has a new job, but. He first appeared in Holy War. It was an NPC that Dennis Detweiler, I think, at one point had run as a player character who graduated to NPC status and now has been immortalized. But so, yeah, he'll be turning up as one of the Delta Green cowboys still out in the cold. And
we saw him in last saw him with his leg horribly broken in Through a Glass Darkly.
Yeah. Yes. He was badly mangled. But he is sort of the consigliere at the moment. He is, his position in Delta Green is the sort of the consigliere to the new age, the new Alphonse. We'll just leave that. Where it is. But I'm also finishing up. Well, I'm about halfway into a short story I'm writing for Stone Skin Press's collection Swords v. Cthulhu. I did write something for their Shotguns v. Cthulhu, which I was very pleased. It stood out in the my story stood out in Shotguns v. Cthulhu for a couple reasons, not the least of which was it was described as written by an author who should have known better. I do not believe that was a compliment. And it also completely cribs Mr. Kramer's Last Things Last. That's basically what it is. It's just a fictionalized version of Mr. Kramer's incredible Delta Green Shotgun scenario from a million years ago, Last Things Last, which is absolutely brilliant. One of the best. It's the kind of thing that, frankly, we need to. I would lobby to throw it in to whatever our next Delta Green, the new Delta Green book, throw it in as a kind of well, sort of like the Corbett House Haunting. I think it's an incredible introductory scenario for players, and that, I'm going to lobby for that. But anyways, the new piece is called Trespassers, and if there's anybody out there who is a fan of Victorian adventuring and derring do, it is sort of a mythosized and fictionalized version of Sir Francis Younghusband and Baron Grumchevsky's fabled meeting in the high plains of China back in 1889, where these two imperial cartographers and explorers met and had the sort of standard, you know, mythical brandy and smokes and dinner out on the high plains of China, and you know, while their Gurkha and Cossack bodyguards glowered at each other, you know, they ran into they're both competing, you know, to map these passes, and when they ran into each other, they did the weird gentleman thing from the 19th century and said, "Hey, want to come to dinner?" and sat down and had this, you know, weird meeting at the top of the, you know, the top of the world. The thing always stood out for me because it's they took a photograph of the two parties together, and I just do not know where you're going to find a photograph of Gurkhas and Cossacks standing next to each other anywhere else except this one, you know, this one box camera shot. But so I'm working on that short story, and finally, Horrors of War is grinding along in sort of trench warfare style, we will have an announcement that by the time this radio or this podcast is broadcast, people will have already gotten their Kickstarter announcement that we've added a bunch of people to the roster of artists. Heather Hudson of Studio Wonder Cabinet, he was a longtime Pagan alumni. She will be contributing some stuff. John T. Schneider, who also longtime Paganista. He's the guy who did Golden Dawn front to back, cover interiors. He also did a lot of stuff for Delta Green and Countdown. Yep. Samuel Raya is happy to rejoin us from Paraguay. Mm-hmm. And he will be sending in some stuff. David Lee Ingersoll is another artist I'm quite fond of, who's a local up here in Seattle. At his website is the Skook Works. We'll try and get those into the show notes. He's going to be joining the show, as is Rick Sardina of battleduck.com. That's his site. Rick does some really brilliant painting. Although I'm not sure, although this time I think he's going to be doing all of our cartography and deck plans for us. And finally, Todd Shearer, who has done a number of projects for Arc Dream in the past. This is the first time I'm going to directly employ Mr. Shearer, but Todd is going to be joining us as well for the project. There's a few people I'm still soliciting to take the King's Shilling and sign up. But that's the ones that we've got in the bag so far. And as far as deadlines go, it's going to be luckily I've got the money to pay them on hand thanks to Kickstarter. So it's just a question of how fast they can start turning stuff into us. I'm really happy to have Snyder on board because the guy is a really, really good technical illustrator. And when it comes to things like, you know, sort of the nuts and bolts technology and hardware of the period, I'm really glad to have him along. Heather is, of course, the person I kind of go to for anything monstrous, where you actually get to see the elephant, you know, as far as see what the problem is. And it still manages to surprise you, even though you're actually getting a good, hard look at whatever the Lovecraftian problem is. And, you know, Sam's great for anything that's... Sam makes nightmare scapes like nobody I know, so I'm really happy to have him with us as well. That's all that's going on with me. Cranking away on Delta Green for Mr. Ivy and for Stone Skin Press there with the Mythos, other than that, it's trying to move this enormous arsenal out of my house. Regretfully move the enormous arsenal out of my house. I am sorry to see it go. My plan was always if John ever fell down the stairs and broke his neck in the basement, my plan was to report to his sister, you know, that, oh, your brother died, and here's his gun. what do you want me to do with his gun? And I think she would have bought that. At least it would have gone. I would have been assured that they would have gone to get a home, you know, with someone who loved them. anyway, so that's it for me.
All right.
Well, Ross, what's happening on your neck of the woods?
Well, I'm finishing up a Kickstarter too, Boiling Point, an adventure for base raiders. I'll be sending out a proofreading draft for backers to look over for final typos.
Wait a minute,
but
you got them to pay for it, and you put them to work.
Well, you know,
you're diabolical.
Why not? I mean, I'm proofreading it as well. I mean,
hold on, Scott. He's giving the fans an opportunity to join in the creation of this awesome.
Wow.
Hey, I took a lesson from Steam. It's called Early Access. Yeah. You know, you help playtest the game.
You took a lesson from Tom Sawyer and whitewashing a fence.
Aside from that, there's also Roleplaying Public Radio now has a Patreon with a bonus podcast called RPPR After Hours, where we review old RPGs and talk about pop culture. In our first, there's one episode available on RPPR that you can take, listen to, see if you like it, where Caleb loses his mind after reading something from ICE, a supplement called Death Valley Free Prison, where in
oh
the
my
grim-
god.
Yes. In the grim dark future, Nevada is turned into a prison where it is stereotype gang versus stereotype gang. Apparently, the Japanese gang gets katanas for some reason, even though they're prisoners.
Oh, wow.
I kind of imagined like a giant samurai helmet flying over like Zardoz, just throwing katanas out and then flying away.
Just belching them out of the mask, out of that. Yeah.
My melted plastic katana has been folded over 1,000 times.
I was gonna say, are they sort of like prison shiv katanas? You know,
I don't think they explain that. They spent too much time making maps for that game. There's a lot of terrible maps in that.
I did listen. Now you previewed that on your
Yes.
And I gotta tell you, it is that game is brilliant in its horribleness. It really is. There's like everything that could be wrong with a game seems to be wrong with it. I mean, it's amazing. They literally did everything.
Yeah, it was a supplement for ICE, you know, the same people who did Rollmaster, but they made a cyberpunk / you know, dystopian sci-fi game, and you know, same
with only a moderate amount of racism.
I played it.
I also in the part two, which is only available to Patreon backers, we review a Ravenloft supplement talking about the Dark Lords of Ravenloft, one of which Count Karkov started life as a panther, and then a wizard turned him into a man so he could get revenge on a woman. So he trained the man panther for years at a boarding school, and then he had seduce the woman.
Was it a boarding school for girls? Because that would be great.
It doesn't really specify. It just takes years to turn a panther to learn how to walk with two legs, apparently, and, you know, use the right dinner fork. And then because the wizard's scheme was to convert the man panther back into a panther when he was making out with the woman, because the woman had scorned the wizard.
The wizard yes. Is a furry?
I vengeful voyeur.
Yeah,
furry.
This is a vengeful furry. This is a okay.
But after that, the wizard was done with the man panther. So the man panther, you know, was a count and decided to become a vampire.
By what lineage? How do you go from I got pooped out the panther to oh yeah, I'm titled?
I think
a wizard literally did it.
Maybe the vampirism came first because all vampires are counts.
No, it specifically says that he looked to become a vampire. He didn't want to die, so he looked up, found out where a vampire was, and said, "Bite me," and said, became it. And that's just one of the Dark Lore. So, anyways, that's kind of the thing we're going into with RPPR After Hours. It's kind of a MST
treatment. I paid my money to the Patreon account.
Thank you. I also run two online games a month for Patreon backers, and they're available for free for anyone to download on the Patreon site. I've already run a game of Base Raiders and recently Eclipse Phase. Many characters died. Everyone had a good time. Next month I'll be running Call of Cthulhu, and I think I'll try and get Aaron and some of the other people to run games as well. So we'll have a lot of bonus content on the Patreon. Desktop wallpaper art based on the actual plays, behind the scene blog posts, and so I'm really excited about it. And so that's my big thing right now.
All right. And so what should people search for if they go to patreon.com?
I think it's just RPPR or Role Playing Public Radio. I'm pretty sure it's just patreon.com/RPPR. We'll take it up. We're up to 150 patrons right now. And there's content for everyone from $2 and up a month. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyways.
All right. Well, so let's hear from our guest.
Hello. We have one.
Yeah, it's not just us tooting our own horns. So I guess, Brett, why don't you give us give our listeners kind of a rundown of what you're up to, and then we'll kind of segue really clumsily from that into a more sprawling kind of discussion of Masks of Nyarlathotep and long-term horror campaigns in general. So
sure.
What are you up to, Brett?
Well, my first question is, are you still taking submissions for the next issue of The Oath?
Always.
Curiosity. Okay. Anyway.
Do you have any good scenarios, speaking of which?
Do you want one set in the Caribbean in 1920? Because I've got an outline.
Yeah, maybe.
But okay. Well, we'll talk about that off the air. Well, what I'm working on right now, about 18 months ago, I started putting out issues of the Arkham Gazette, which was a free e-zine set all about Lovecraft Country, the 1920s setting for Call of Cthulhu from Chaosium. They published a series of source books for the major towns and a couple scenario collections, but haven't really done much with it since, you know, the late 90s probably. But I always loved the setting, and I had some ideas for it, and had some sort of material left over that was got to be used by Miskatonic River Press before Keith Herbert died, but unfortunately that did not work out, obviously. So I decided to do just I love the setting and I wanted to do something constructive, and I didn't there I mean there you know the Unspeakable Oath is a fabulous magazine, but its focus is definitely modern. And you know, considering that the Black Seal is still working on issue 4 after 12 years. though I've heard dark rumors it may actually get released. I've seen dire PDFs that indicate it may be true.
I promise we're not we're not that dedicated to the 21st century. Please, I've got an article I keep trying to get done for the Oath. It's about clipping services, so you can do Grandpa's Google in 1920. I promise you, we got plenty of room in the Oath.
Well, yeah, since Lovecraft Country itself is really the only true campaign setting for Call of Cthulhu, and I'll try to enunciate my words. Sorry.
Thank you.
You know, it's I just had a fondness for it, and I had a lot of stuff I was sort of half finished with before Miskatonic River Press shut down, or sort of converted over to whatever they became. They're in a cocoon right now, I suspect. Mm-hmm. So I just sort of self-published it, using my meager Word editing skills to make some PDFs. Most of it was written by myself, but I got some awesome submissions from some, authors I knew and some I didn't. And I just ran a Kickstarter in December for making issue number 3, actually making it available in print or print on demand, and actually paying our contributors. So that was very, very successful. It raised a lot more money than I expected. Not quite enough to move to Portland, but...
is that a goal? Is that a goal, sir? Have you fallen in love?
No, it's sort of a... There's a... Was it the Shadow Over Atlantic City guy who absconded with a lot of funds and apparently used it all to move to Portland?
Not the actual... Not the creator and the illustrator, but the guy who... Yeah.
Yeah, the other guy.
Yeah.
So, but it was, I was very, very flattered that people were interested. So I am currently trying to get our issue number 3 about witches and witchcraft done. Most of it is written. I am still hashing out the scenario. The scenario was submitted, the scenario by Chris Huth was submitted, but there are parts where he's like, some Lovecraft Country spot and, expand, which he told me that feel free to do so. And I have been, but that is the last thing I'm really working on. I'm still kind of hashing out a couple bits and pieces of one more article, just sort of summarizing the whole colonial witchcraft trials. But I think I've got most of that done. So I'm just trying to hash out the scenario, and then we'll move into layout.
I have a question about your witchcraft trials. I have one question about your witchcraft trials. At any point, do you drop in that Cotton Mather sign-off where he'd sign his letters? You know what I'm talking about?
I don't think so. No.
Whenever he'd sign off his letters, he would write, "Yours in the bowels of Christ." I found suspicious. Just saying,
Yeah. I mean, we do mention that he actually wasn't present at most of the executions, despite what Lovecraft says in Pickman's Model. But
yeah.
I don't think we included his Christ bowels comments.
Scott, yeah. are you sure that wasn't just a colonial era way of spelling bowls?
Yeah. the other thing that's charming about Cotton is that there's a marvelous book called Rum, and if you've ever, it's about the booze trade in America, particularly in early colonial times. And apparently Cotton Mather, upstanding Puritan, was up to his eyeballs in the illegal rum trade.
Oh, a lot of them were, and
It's charming in its hypocrisy. He also is apparently involved in trying to convince his rum running buddies that they should hijack another group of Christians who are coming to the Massachusetts colony and sell them into slavery in the Caribbean because,
Well, I mean, it worked for the praying Indians in the aftermath of King Philip's War. So,
yeah. Yeah, so it's he's a charming guy.
Oh yeah, I mean he's definitely an interesting character. He wasn't a proponent of inoculation, which I guess puts him ahead of some people today. But
great, he wrote a book called The Invisible World, but he believed in vaccination.
Yes.
All right.
So once we get issue 3, I think we'll have a draft out. Hopefully, have a draft out to backers soon. I don't know exactly when, since. It'll just be a rough draft, and then we'll actually turn it into a print-on-demand release, and then we'll finish converting issues. Our demo issue is done and should be released soon once I get that back from Chris Huth, who's also doing the layout, and then issues 1 and 2 will be upgraded from my very meager editing layout skills into actual nice-looking, hopefully, books. And then we'll move on to future projects like soliciting for issue number 4. Mm-hmm. So
it's kind of fun though, because as you said, the Oath and most of the magazines that, you know, are sort of similar to the Oath, the Oath is kind of scattershot, you know. I mean, it doesn't have a really deep focus on one particular era or setting or even mode of play, because it's kind of more about, you know, a lot of different ways of approaching Cthulhu Mythos horror. And so sure. With Arkham Gazette, what you're doing is really, really drilling down on Lovecraft Country, and particularly Lovecraft Country as seen through the lens of like 1920s and 30s classic era gaming, which I love, because that's, you know, potentially that's a really deep topic, and there's just so many details there that you can bring into your games to really, really spice things up and make them evocative for your players. And most people don't have a lot of time to do the research on, you know, what was day-to-day life like, or what did people actually think about this belief or that belief. And
the advantage of I was at least when I started was living in New England at that point, so a lot of the research was a lot easier to do for me, because I could just, yeah, you know, go down to Providence or go to the local library or historical society and get some
just
information.
Just go to Innsmouth. Just skip down the road.
Practically. I mean, I did, honestly, I did several driving tours just to look at some sites that inspired Lovecraft. So,
yeah, that's fun. And I personally like the, in the previews here, you've already got a thing on folk magic and some mm-hmm. things on sort of, you know, fairies and that play into folk tales and folk magic, which is lots of fun. I've been trying to convince a local friend of mine for a long time that we ought to get together and co-run some kind of a sort of colonial era or pre-revolutionary era game of kind of exploration folk magic in the new world. And
eventually 60 Stone's supposed to be releasing a Colonial Cthulhu set of books, and I know that's in the works, but I don't know what the stat. Last I heard, Adam Crossingham was was working in the planning stages for that, but since he's mm-hmm. sort of lost all his time working on the companion, mm-hmm. plus some other issues, I don't know what the stat. Hopefully, that's moving forward. Is all I'll say.
We actually play tested a campaign here at Pagan that Brian Appleton wrote that was all set set on the Great Plains in the 1820s, playing Indians. You didn't play the white folks.
Yeah,
you played Arapaho, and that was awesome. A completely alien culture, completely different way of approaching the supernatural.
Right.
Treating the white people as creepy, weird, disease-carrying aliens that, you know, that are best to avoid.
Didn't know a thing about how to keep the gods happy, and we're always...
not a thing. Right. You know, anytime, you know, that's the funny thing about COC is I think we have the entire tapestry of human experience to pull from. Creating mm-hmm. scenarios. Hell, was it David Mana who wrote, was it Cursed Be the City?
The Neanderthal one, I think.
Yes, where you play Neanderthals who are being, you know, controlled by the ruins of an even older civilization. And I just love the whole part. You know, it was just great with the whole trying to communicate to the Neanderthals. It's kind of like a cave, only it doesn't have a mountain around it. You know, trying to describe these buildings and these ruins. You know, it works. It works at any time you've got mostly evolved monkeys. You can run a Call of Cthulhu scenario, no problem.
It's all of us. Yeah. I ran last year, or maybe the year before last. Now I don't know. Anyway, a while ago, I ran an online like Google Hangouts run of the Dead of Winter, the first chapter in Walker in the Wastes, and And I had a really great time running that because I put a good bit of work into kind of making sure I had my head wrapped around the Inuit culture of the 1920s as well as I could, and kind of presented them and their priorities and their attitude towards things and towards interacting with the, you know, with the Americans and Canadians as accurately as I can manage from my limited perspective. But it was kind of fun because even that one culture was sort of so loaded with mythology that can very easily be seen as, you know, really creepy because they're a culture that sort of evolved surrounding by very imminent death. You did a simple, right? So,
any environment that's shitty usually produces, usually produces a very ruthless religion. If you come from, you know, the tougher your environment is, you know, the more prone to natural disasters. Yeah. And so, yeah, they have very unforgiving gods.
Right. Right. So anyway, so back to Arkham Gazette. I think that's it's fun. And it's fun to see kind of what kind of material gets put together for that. So what kind of, you had a good successful Kickstarter project edition, and I take it you've gotten some good response on the work that's gone into it so far. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we've only had a few reviews. We won runner up magazine of the year on Die Hard Game Fan. I don't know what the voting pool is there, but that was, you know, it's kind of strange to see tie with Gygax magazine.
Yeah.
I think we're a little bit of a smaller operation. Not too much because this is hot the gaming hobby, but
you probably still had the edge on the oath in that you had a new issue come out.
Well, yeah, but you had one out last year too. But I think
that's right.
It was very well. Yeah, I remember because I like to stare at it and smile because I had an article in it.
Which one was your last issue?
The Cult of A was me.
Oh, the Cult of yes, that was brilliant. You're awful. You're a terrible human being.
That was one of the few things. I mean, normally I do too much research, and then I say, let's scale back and only use the stuff that's interesting. And that one, I think I've read enough about, you know, the pro anorexia movement for my life now. I'm not going to do it anymore.
Yeah, anytime as a writer you can feel your own sanity score viscerally dropping, you know, you're onto something.
Well, when you wrote back after I submitted it and you said, you know, the thing you found creepiest was something that turned out to be from the real world.
Yes.
Like, oh, I actually didn't make up that Ten Commandments that was found online.
Wow.
Oh, that's, yeah, that was brutal. Yeah.
That's really depressing, sir.
Yeah, it was, but I thought I was trying to come up, you know, I like cults and organizations that aren't worship the tentacle god, bring sacrifices to tentacle god, get mowed down by guys with Thompson submachine guns in service of the tentacle god. So
we'll get to all that when we talk about masks in a minute.
Sure.
But the cult of A was terrific work. And
yeah, so I'm very proud of that. So I smile happily at the issue 24 of The Oath.
Yeah. I hope you'll forgive us that we didn't use a picture of a horribly depressing anorexic woman as the cover art for you. But
I am okay with that.
But the
illustration of A itself was horrifying enough that I didn't need to see it on the cover.
Right. Yes. Yeah. All right. So let's talk about the Masks Companion.
Sure.
Yes,
Masks
please.
Of Nyarlathotep in general, and you know, I'm always interested in kind of batting ideas and notes around for long term play for horror campaigns, because my favorite, you know, my favorite Cthulhu experience was in the 80s when me and my friends were playing Call of Cthulhu, and it was a long-term campaign where with mostly the same characters we went through the Terror from the Stars, the little Chaosium source book that had a couple of Central American adventures, and then
and then
Shadows of Yog-Sothoth, and then the first few chapters of Masks And then things happened. but it was a long-term thing, you know, and it was really interesting to have kind of these ongoing characters. And so, in horror games, that's a really particular challenge. So I guess let's start with the companion, though, because you've put a whole lot of time and work.
Do we actually have to tell anybody what Massive Narothotep is, or do you think that they've found their way to Unspeakable? They know what we're talking about.
Yeah.
A brief introduction couldn't hurt. It is the classic world-hopping campaign of Call of Cthulhu. Right. So you written in 1984, I believe, by Larry DiTilio, and it involves thwarting the actions of the mini cults of Nyarlathotep, the masks, in other words, as the adventurer starts in New York, and then they can choose where they want to go next, from London to Cairo to Kenya to Shanghai to, or later on in the 96 edition, Australia.
I am presuming that you still have to, the ultimate sort of, you know, it all has to end on Grey Dragon Island.
Well, I mean, you could hypothetically end it.
Spoiler alert. But... This discussion will have some spoilers in it.
Yeah, let's get that out of the way first.
You'll notice I didn't say where Grey Dragon Island is.
Let's just say from the outset, we're planning on spoiling everything in Mask of Nyarlathotep in the next few minutes. So if you have not played through it, then...
Or you're currently playing through it, i.e. the players who are in my game right now and might be listening.
Pause this recording, play back, go back and play through the entirety of Mask of Nyarlathotep, and then come back and listen.
Yeah.
So that said, Masks is pretty among Call of Cthulhu gamers, it's pretty consistently, you know, the thing that makes everybody start slavering and saying it's the best thing ever written for any role playing game ever. Myself included.
Is it equivalent to the D&D sort of, what was that underground campaign where you go down and you beat up the deep ones
against the giants, and then the
well, there's the Temple of there's actually a couple of for D&D, like there's that, there's the Temple of Elemental Evil.
The lethality of masks could easily be compared to Tomb of Horrors.
Depending on how you play it, sure.
So Masks sort of came out of early era when Temple of Elemental Evil was being converted from an adventure into a long form, you know, really big campaign. And the next year is when that came out. And then, of course, the Descent into the Depths series with the giants and the drow and all that. Was the end of the 70s and first part of the, like, 79-ish. But Masks was the one of the first big campaign books that kind of held together. You know, it was its own thing, and it was built to be its own interrelated story and collection of stories that you play together, as opposed to just, here's a dungeon, and then later you buy another dungeon that's you know, has a door in it from that previous dungeon if you want to do that.
What's interesting is because I'm running Masks, and thanks to the advice of Mr. Scott Glancy, I've been pulling in a lot of material from other books, and like Cthulhu Casebook and Fearful Passages and a lot of other stuff. And I've been reading a lot of these old, like, early 1980s Call of Cthulhu adventures, and they're, like, in terms of their structure, they're a lot like the early D&D adventures. Like, in Cthulhu Casebook, right after the Mauritania, I was just reading through the Cthulhu Casebook, and they talk about, I forgot the name of it, it's like the Time Gate adventure. It's literally like a three-page write-up. Yeah, it's like, oh, you're hired to go investigate some weird noises on this hill. And the backstory is some elder things show up from a time gate and they're chased by Shoggoths. And there's also a dinosaur in Arkham. Yep. Go have fun.
Yep.
And when, like, you don't see that. That was the kind of scenarios in, like, Trail of Cthulhu Adventures written by Kenneth Hite. So,
right.
Mask of Nyarlathotep, I think, is interesting because the way the scenario is written, the structure of it is a lot more sophisticated than a lot of the other scenarios of its era.
Yeah.
Definitely. I mean, you've got some, I mean, there's actual, literal dungeon crawls in the first couple Cthulhu collections. I think Black Devil Mountain or something is basically a D&D dungeon ported over to Cthulhu. It's like, oh, there are six ghouls in this room, and then there are five trolls and a grell, and there's several corpses, and oh, look, it's a star spawn of Cthulhu in a 10x10 room with 1,000 gold pieces.
Yeah, there's a number of them that have that smell, or at least they feel like they're structured in a way where it's like, okay, and then here's this critter, and you have to fight it, and it's like, you realize you haven't actually provided the players with anything other than a combat resolution for this scenario. You know what I mean? It's just it wasn't like a you had the opportunity to find the thing that has the banishing that, you know, can get rid of the Dark Young of Shub-Niggurath. It's like, no, there's just this thing where there's two Dark Youngs, and now you're gonna tango with a couple of Dark Youngs at the same time, and I'm like, I. Really? And what do I?
Yeah, it's like,
what do I do for an encore? Pass through its
wreck. You're scared of it, aren't you?
Yeah. Well, there's that, but it seems, as far as I'm concerned, you know, they seem to be written for very direct confrontations that were going to be lethal to the players.
I think the difference is that Larry DiTilio was and is, you know, a screenwriter and a novelist, and a lot of the early scenario authors were wargamers. And I think that approach is sort of fundamental to the robustness of Masks. I mean, I don't want to say that it's a perfect campaign. I don't, right. I know people are
had to write a 600-page campaign if it was perfect.
No, that's true. I mean, it
would only be 200 pages.
Yeah, exactly. Just fill out some stuff that, you know, we figured out in the meantime. But no, but I think it approaches it in a novelistic or, you know, literary way. So it's more of a story than it is a series of connected combats with some, you know, thread of narrative holding it together. Yeah. And I think, you know, unlike I can't say I speak to the origins of some of the very earliest campaigns for Call of Cthulhu, but I'm pretty sure, like, Shadows of Yogg-Sothoth was not written as a campaign. It was, hey, we have these six scenarios. Let's put them together.
They're absolutely not written as a campaign. I mean, there's no doubt. In fact, they've copped to it. They're strung together.
Looged, sort of.
Yeah.
What I like about Shadows, I think that's the one with the Order of the Silver Twilight Lodge. Yeah. I actually pulled some material from that, too, for Masks. The players went on a detour to Boston.
Let me ask this question. Hold on. Before we go any further, I know I suggested this to Ross, using the Silver Twilight Lodge as a introduction to Masks of Nyarlathotep. So you can have your encounter with Carl Sanford, right? So when he shows up, he means something, you know, because otherwise... You know, he's back from what? If you never played Shadows, it doesn't mean anything to you. But if you kill Smith at the is it Smith or Scott?
There's John Scott, which is makes me suspicious of Tynes personally. But
but if you get rid of John Scott in the Silver Twilight and Sanford escapes, you know, then he has a reason to turn up at the end in of Masks and be important. But I always thought that I got the idea because when I was reading through Masks, there was a thing from in the New York section from Miriam Atwood. Atwright.
Yeah.
The librarian who tells you that the New York Library's copy of Africa's Dark Sex is missing. And in the 1989 and the 1990 versions, I believe, of Mass that I've got, both of them say that it just disappeared from the shelves, that it's just vanished, and there's no sign of it, and maybe there was a strange smell in the stacks. But I somehow remember something about, like, there being something like the book disappeared, it was you know, mailed, interlibrary loaned to John Scott at the Cellar of Twilight Lodge, and they claim they sent it back, you know, and they've got postal receipts, and it's just disappeared in transit. And that was a connection. I thought, well, that's a weird dangling thing that's a, you know, call out to the Silver Twilight Lodge. I wonder why. Yeah, I wonder if Silver Twilight Lodge was originally an intro to Masks.
I've
never been able to find that. I mean, I thought that there was a mention in an earlier version of Masks, but when I went to look it up after suggesting it to Ross, I can never find it. Did I just make that shit up myself, or am I
hallucinating? I think there's one of the tomes that John Scott is responsible for stealing. Let me check my notes.
Well, that's what I took that and ran with it, and that's why the players went to Boston, was to try and find that book by infiltrating the Order's open house meeting, basically, which ended with interesting results. I think things were set on fire.
You think?
Yeah.
It was an old wooden building filled with cultists.
Yeah. Well, the players didn't realize. Yeah. I don't want to spoil that. That'll be the next episode of the actual play podcast, actually. But the my point was in Shadows of Yogg-Sothoth is like I was reading through it. I didn't read it cover to cover, but I read through like one chapter. It's like literally, okay, the cult wants to kill them. This adventure is just basically an ambush. The cultists are going to lure them away and just try and off them. There's nothing that they can gain. It's just we're going to try and kill the character. If they're getting too cocky, use this adventure. And that's an interesting mentality.
Well, yeah, there's the one where, hey, why don't you take a relaxing yacht cruise?
That's it. That's the one I was thinking of. Yeah.
And or hey, I hear there's some clues in this old isolated shack. Why don't you? I'm sure that there are no cannibal hillbillies. Why don't you check it out? Those two just stand out as like, really? This is just you know. Certainly, the cannibal hillbilly one is just a wargaming combat thing. You know.
Yeah. Which you don't see in Mask. The one thing I also, you know, you mentioned, you know, DiTullio's background as a novelist and screenwriter is there is this sort of story. There is a better narrative to it than the earlier campaigns, but it also respects the game part of Call of Cthulhu because it's a non-linear campaign.
Yeah.
After New York, the players get to choose where they go. And there's sort of this suggested order of, you know, New York, London, Cairo, Kenya, Australia, Shanghai. But, like, for example, my player skipped Cairo, and I don't know if they're going to go back to – they went from New York, London to Kenya and with interesting results. but I really admire that, and that's one of the reasons – like, for – I wrote a campaign, Road Trip, for Monsters and Other Childish Things, and I deliberately copied that structure. Like, here's your intro scenario, and then, hey, you have clues. You can go to any of these other hubs for quests and you know.
Well, it's certainly that sandbox format, and I guess I think it's fair to call it an early version of sandbox, flew in the face of everything that we had seen in the, you know, room one, room two, you know, oh, maybe you have a four-way intersection in the dungeon, you know. It flew in the face of that standard railroad, and it's something that's pretty much informed everything I've ever wanted to write, and giving the players the kind of freedom to push in every direction, and that was an incredible. That, I mean, you know, say what you like about Horror on the Orient Express. Well, it literally is a railroad. You will now encounter these things in the order.
At least tell you that at the start.
they do telegraph that a little bit, that what you're going to be expecting, but. That whole freeform thing of Max, that the world is a sandbox of mythos nasty, really works 100% for.
And it even throws a few like red herring locations in, which the sort of if you follow, I mean they're minor clues, but if you decide you need to go check out the, you know, I think like Costa Rica or something gets one mention in a ledger and a couple other places that my players decided to fixate on.
Has anyone ever, speaking of places that are only mentioned once, has anyone ever found Carlyle in his asylum in Hong Kong?
Well, we did add a chapter for Hong Kong in the companion.
Oh, good. Because it always bothered me that they, like, Carlyle is in an asylum in Hong Kong, and there's literally no way to get to him. There's no, I mean, Unless Brass.
No, Jack Brady knows where he is.
Yeah.
So if you get Jack Brady and you somehow convince him to take you to Carlisle.
And there's one, I think there's one other witness who ran into Brady in Hong Kong.
Yeah, Nails Nelson in
yeah.
Kenya.
So, I mean,
who
those,
was actually Aaron took over in my campaign, played him.
Wow.
Nails?
And held off. Yeah, he played Nails and tried to hold off a horde of cultists
that's,
with an
that's
elf.
That's not particularly feckless. I thought he was supposed to have more feck than that.
Well, yeah, he was. I think one of his skills is think before, act before thinking, or something like that.
Aaron, or
yeah, I think. Well, the write up. Like again, I love how Call of Cthulhu gives NPCs unusual skills.
Yes.
You know, those little quirk skills. But anyway, I've actually run masks twice. The first time I ran it was in Call of Cthulhu, and I ran it very much by the book. And it was a very lethal campaign. I think there were like 12 to 15 fatalities or zero permanent insanities through the course of the campaign. And like I like to say, players started by making like professors and police detectives and that kind of thing. And by the end of it, it was like gun runner, KGB assassin,
right.
Other KGB assassin, you know, and like. There was
anarchists. I'm taking an anarchist and a gangster.
Yeah, exactly. and now I'm, the second time around, I'm on the Trail of Cthulhu, and we haven't had quite as many fatalities yet. But I mean, still, they're I don't know. It's still a very lethal campaign.
When it came out, there was that everyone just came off of D&D. So when force failed, you applied more force.
Yeah.
With the consistent results of failure.
It's interesting.
So you run it twice. Brett, how many times do you run masks?
I have run it only once, but I kept all of my old notes from it, which sort of was part of the inspiration for the companion, since I had a lot of like question marks and places I underlined. I had a photocopy of it, actually. So I had marked up the text heavily and was like, what the heck is this? Or how do I fix this? So it's kind of the
Mr. Ivy?
I played through it once, and I've run it once.
I have done neither.
Oh.
I have done neither. I have ruminated on it. I have caressed it, and I have, you know, generally fawned and over it and coveted it. But I have never been able to get a group of people to who I could get to commit to all that right. much time.
Well, it's been nice talking to you, Scott, and...
Didn't Detweiler and John Tynes or something or somebody meet playing it, or maybe it was John Tynes, like the nucleus of the Unspeakable Oath crew originally was playing through the game, I thought.
Now Dennis, I believe, has run it once, at least. He's played in it once because he died on Grey Dragon Island. John Tynes has played through it, and John Crow has run it, I think, once or twice, at least once. John Tynes died in it several dozen times. he may in fact hold the record of quickest death in masks, having gotten killed at the foot of the fire escape outside of Jackson Elias's hotel.
Wow.
You know, yeah, having chased three cultists down the fire escape with a double-barreled shotgun.
And, impressive.
And then missed. So do the math on how that worked out for him.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's how they all met in college, was playing. Those guys did meet up in college playing masks. But no, I've never gotten anyone to sit down with it. Now, which is hilarious, because here I am giving advice to, trying to give advice to Ross when he's playing masks. Like, I have anything to really say about it, except that, you know, again, you know, you ruminate on it. Masks is one of these things, is, you know, you hear other people's stories about it, how they've played it, you ruminate on it, you see the potential for this thing. It really is, even in its primitiveness compared to, you know, a lot of modern gaming materials, it has a very wide horizon of possibilities for the players. And the story is one of the most complex. There are no punches pulled about how complex the story of the Carlisle expedition is.
Mm-hmm. It's very Yeah, it's very easy for a campaign to enter into a fail state. You know, like they just run into a wall because they went to the wrong place or talked to the wrong person, and like now a certain clue is missing. You know, there's only a few places where you can figure out what the plot is or what the cultists are really up to, and there's only a few places where you can really stop them. And if you do anything else, you're kind of screwed. So,
and there's a certain air of tragedy about the villains in this. They're not just mustachioed, you know, guys in top hats putting people on the railroad track. They're all kind of broken people who end up doing dumb things.
I mean, certainly the Carlisle expedition is, but there are plenty of mustache twirling.
Well, yes, but the end of the members of the expedition, with maybe the exception of Penhue, are all, you know, I mean, you know, you've got Carlisle who's insane, Hypatia Masters who's no longer human.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Huston's nuts, so he's kind of a pathetic lunatic and delusional. And that's just
and Jack Brady is, you know,
suicidal. Just,
yeah, essentially. And the thing, it has this great epic story that, like, can if you can get through it, like it has a lot of foreshadowing and like it reinforces every point, which I really admire because a lot of RPGs, especially in the long game. Kind of don't fulfill all the promises they sort of try and, you know, they a lot of games, I think a lot of RPGs can't write the checks that they, you know, want to. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like they
yeah.
But Mass does, but there are these pitfalls where players can just, you turn the corner and, oh, this is the TPK situation. You weren't sufficiently paranoid to maybe, I don't know, not look at that painting.
Yeah.
The NPC they want
you to go talk to happens to be one of the main villains of the game. Yeah.
That actually was one of the best stories of the first time I ran the campaign is in London. And I think I've told this story before. In London, one of my players, Tom, they just got in London. They were trying to do some legwork, trying to figure out what was going on. And Tom said, well, this guy used to work for the Carlisle expedition. He owns a tea shop. I'll go talk to him. And so he goes to talk to the tea shop owner in London, who, if you've read the book, know who that is. And it's in the middle of the day. And then during the course of the conversation, Tom realizes, oh, shit, that guy's a cultist. He panics, and I tell the other players are yelling at him, like telling him what to do, and he's like, and I say, everyone, shut up, Tom, what are you doing? I grab my cane, I beat him, I attack him. And all right, so the cultist doesn't have time to cast any spells or anything because he's just as surprised. And so Tom beats him to death with his cane. But it's the middle of the day and it's bloody work. So I have a woman come in and it's like, oh, have you got the tea ready? Oh my goodness. And so Tom, what do you do?
I see this felony expanding.
Tom was like, no witnesses. He kills that woman and makes a sand check, you know, drags the body away, tries to clean up.
How do you tell the cultists from the investigators again? I forget.
Then I say her fiance comes in. And at that point, Tom runs away. But he was just like, everyone was on the edge of their seat. I wish I could have recorded it. It was before I had a recorder. But it was 10 years ago, and I still remember it. And that's sort of the joy. You don't know what to expect in certain games.
Wow.
Yeah.
Can I just say that I listened to the guys from YoggSothoth.com listen to their playthrough of Masks of Nyarlathotep. And the thing that was most painful, most teeth grindingly painful, was listening to them go everywhere and say, we're friends of Jackson Elias. He got murdered and we wanted to know if you, Mr. Shakti, might know anything about this. And they did this everywhere. And every encounter with every person was, well, I'd like to be helpful, but I don't know anything. Perhaps you could give me all of your names and what hotel you're staying in. And every time they went, we're staying here. And there's just this human wave of robed cultists flying through the windows at them constantly, and they have the gall to be surprised every single time, as if like, well, the game master's just throwing the stuff at us because he can, not because they've done anything to make it happen. You know,
they were like the gaming equivalent of people emailing with Nigerian princes.
Yeah. Yeah. And if there's anything I've learned, the first thing I look at with Mass is everybody I've ever heard of who've run the game, almost everybody I've heard whose players ran it, approached it kind of similarly. They always show up, and for the first couple of encounters are, hi, we're friends of Jackson Elias. We heard he got murdered by some cultists. You got any cultists around here? You know, and with the expected results. Almost nobody ever takes the approach that has become sort of my standard Call of Cthulhu approach, which is you never give your real name, and you never say you're looking for the thing you're looking for. You take the Jim Rockford approach to... I'm serious. There's
slow driving in the 70s.
Yeah.
There's nothing about cognitive investigation that Jim Rockford can't teach you. And basically, you always go in pretending to be somebody other than you are, and you're not asking for the piece of information that you want. You're asking for information adjacent to it. And then, oh, just one more thing, you know, and pick it up at the last second. And, you know, if you ran it like that, your lethality would drop through the floor.
My players got burned pretty badly in London, and after that point, they became exceptionally paranoid.
Yeah.
To the point where they were surveilling people before they talked to them. And
good.
I think at one point, you know, they simply decided to avoid that certain gentleman in Cairo because they suspected he might be up to something, which saved them a lot of hurt.
Yeah.
But you know. I mean, I think they treat dynamite with them all the time. It was nuts.
It's a role playing game though, so you kind of have to have some, you know, you have to have some justification for the characters to suddenly start thinking in those terms, right?
Yeah, so I think that was grew organically in that my game, but you certainly can't have a bunch of professors just, you know, kidnapping Edward Gavigan before they interview him and torturing him trying to get information.
Well, yeah. Why does it always have to end in a kidnapping, okay? I know a lot of players go, I can't figure it out. Let's beat somebody until they talk. Uh-huh. I always found a way, you know, at least in Masks, you have a great way to discourage that. And that is you're surrounded by these cartoony cultists who will die before talking.
Yeah.
You know, so if the players do that once, it should, the lesson should be, well, that didn't get us anywhere. Mm-hmm. You know, get back to doing some actual investigation and lay off the torture.
Well, what I did for the whole tradecraft aspect of it, and sort of also as a help way to frame the campaign to get the players, also just to introduce them to Trail of Cthulhu, because I'm talking about my current run. I don't remember what I did for my first run, but for my first run or for this run, I started with some prequel adventures.
Yes.
And the first one I did was Shanghai Bullets from Stunning Eldritch Tales, mm-hmm. which is a Trail of Cthulhu supplement. And it's Shanghai Bullets is a great thing. It's actually, now that I think about it, a great primer for teaching paranoia to players.
Yeah.
Because the central premise of the adventure is there's a MacGuffin, a mythos artifact, in Shanghai, which I pushed it back to 1925 or 1924, so it would be in time for Masks, but... in 1930, Shanghai, in that same era, there's a lot of, well, intrigue going on. So basically, every faction wants that artifact, and the players quickly develop like, oh crap, we can't talk to anybody because they'll kill us to steal the artifact, and so that got them in and they wound up with the artifact, but it's an indestructible artifact, so they. Didn't know what to do with it. They didn't feel comfortable throwing it into the Pacific Ocean for some reason. So I then ran another prequel adventure called The Dream Factory, which is from...
from Mortal Coils.
Yeah, Mortal Coils, and that's set in Hollywood. And there's actually another evil artifact in that one, which could be used to destroy the first evil artifact. And the second evil artifact is not indestructible. So the players figured out how to remove two great evil artifacts from the world.
Ah, yes. Yes, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I explained it to you, and it's on the podcast if you want to listen to it. But after the, and I also introduced Jackson Elias as a character in that game, which he would like, oh, let's investigate this artifact and let's test it to see if we can, you know, melt it with acid or explode it or shoot it, you know, and like, oh, can't do any of those things. So the players were very paranoid very early on because they learned through their first adventure, like, holy crap, their people will kill us if we reveal who we are and what we're trying to do.
So what is, yeah. Can I get everyone to sound off on what the most paranoid thing that any players did during Masks?
Well, in the prequel adventure, they actually weren't sure Jackson Elias was their ally or was who he says he was. So they had him show up at a fake place and followed him for a day before they actually allowed him in.
I was thinking of something a little crazier than that. That's actually a really good idea. I'm in favor of that one. What about you, Shane?
I remember as a player, when we got to England, which was the place where we all met Destiny, we first tried to hedge our bets by recruiting some aid from the underground because, you know, several of our characters were long-term investigators and therefore had ties with the criminal element all over the place. And so we tried to get some help, you know, some muscle and lots of spared guns and so forth, even though we were in England. And
would you go talk to the IRA?
It was, I don't remember exactly what, but it, you know, it was London gangsters or something like that. We made contact with. And
so it went all Guy Ritchie.
Yeah. And it didn't help.
All right. How about you, Brett?
The most paranoid thing I ever saw was when I ran Horror on the Orient Express, when my player character straight up just started murdering Turks. just because they could be in the blood, they could be in the Skinless One cult. In Mass, I think they knowingly let one of the, like, I don't remember if she was an NPC or I think the character, the person who played her wasn't there that week. They let her get kidnapped by Lin Tang Yu, so they could trail him back to his castle. And, like, you know, they gave her something to, you know, like, she was a cat burglar or something. And the plan was to have her try to break out while they stormed the gates. And, you know, I think they picked up, like, I think they found the guy that got that Thompson they were looking for, and they immediately, like, emptied a clip into one of the albino apes, and then it jammed and never worked again. And just sort of like, just, and they just, they're sort of like, they basically planned.
Now, wait a minute. I asked about paranoia, not fiasco. We're going to get to the fiascos in a minute.
Well, they just assumed that, you know, they were willing to do terrible things because they figured the guy was bad, even without any clear evidence to the contrary.
Okay, but the broken clock was right.
Well, yes. Yeah. Unlike the poor, you know, strangled guys on the Orient Express who were completely innocent.
My players also in the Trail of Cthulhu decided to skip Cairo. It's just out of complete paranoia. Oh, wait, I actually know one paranoid thing they've done is they hate coming into ship now because literally every chapter of Masks opens up. There's someone watching them at the port and will start tailing them. They've gotten kind of frustrated or annoyed at the fact that the cultists are watching all the ships that are coming into all these major cities. So when they spotted someone in a recent chapter, watching them, they're like, oh, I know, we'll just go up and talk to them. Hey, are you so-and-so? You look like him. Hey, what's going on in this city? And just the cultist was so flustered, he didn't know what to do. And so my carefully prepared plans didn't work out that way. As they just, because they were out in public and the cultists shouldn't, can't we go in this alley so I can stab you conveniently? Oh, there's six of you.
My players did turn down taking the train from Mombasa to Nairobi because they were convinced something bad would happen. So they hiked the whole way, which was an impressive waste of time for them. But true.
And yet, they're not on fire. So you got to give credit that they're not on fire.
I actually skipped that part because they had just in the London chapter, they went out to the countryside to deal with the Vane family and they were attacked on the train on the way back. So I didn't want two train attacks in a row. I think that would have been a little much, but I think, so
Jared Wallace of Dagon Industries suggested two of my favorite paranoid moves. One is one that I've heard other players do, and that is they start checking into hotels under their real name, and then they will check into a hotel across the street from the hotel that they're checked into under a false name and get a room that provides a firing solution onto the hotel room, right? So they're just sitting up in the other hotel, you know, with all their luggage in the first hotel room, just sitting up there with high-powered hunting rifles waiting for the cultists to come search their room.
Well, I think it was the gaming...
Trying to steal their artifacts, which happened a few times.
I think the gaming grunts, when they played through it on their actual play podcast, found like the Idol of Cthulhu that has a really high sanity cost in Gavigan's basement. And so they put that in front of the door. So anytime anyone came in the room, they'd like suffer like a D6 sanity loss.
Yeah, but how does that bother the cultists? You know,
they thought it had a magical power. They were wrong.
Oh, they were wrong.
Cthulhu will protect us.
The other one that was astounding was Wallace had said that his game group were so, it was because they're traveling around the world. The first thing that they would do when they arrived in a new country is buy the local shoes so that they wouldn't leave American shoe footprints when they were skulking around. So they go, these shoes are American, you know, we should be looking for Americans, you know. So they'd get the local shoes so his footprints would blend in, and then they'd get them in the wrong size. Well, looking for a man with size 14 shoes. And they, you know, because they got a shoe that was four sizes too big. It would somehow throw the cultists off. And I'm like, that is some excellent paranoia. That is actually like missed sand roll paranoia. It's not going to help. But it's a ritual they're doing to keep themselves safe. You know?
Wow. That's pretty amazing. That kind of reminds me of like how bootleggers would wear shoes with cow footprints on them to conceal where their stills were to the cops. But the idea of the cultists being that on the ball, most of the cultists are pretty like the average thug is like some blue collar worker or something
less. I mean, they're gutter sweepings, and I feel like it's not. The evil masterminds are evil masterminds in the classic pulp style, but a keeper really ought to let the minions fuck up because the minions are fuck ups.
Yeah,
you know, they are. They're losers, and it would behoove a group of players, you know, and a keeper to at least if he's gonna have the minions doing the attacks or doing the things, have them blow it because you know they are. You know, they are these very, you know, they're fringe characters who are drug addicts and addle-minded, you know, and it whatever advantages the players can get from the material they really ought to have, you know, because it is so lethal.
Oh, certainly. I mean, that's one of the things we tried to focus on in the companion is ways in which the cults themselves, you know, present opportunities for the players to, you know, escape danger or, you know, reasonable tools the keeper can employ to save, you know, a character who's in some sort of trouble. The one I remember best is the fact that, you know, you've got two different titular leaders of the London cult of the Black Pharaoh. And, you know, we basically present a discussion of the cult talking about how, you know, each of them, we sort of suggest that each of them is preparing to remove the other in a sort of, you know, occult Knight of the Long Knives move. And they each, you know, they're sort of waiting on knife edge for some advantage for the reason to knock off the other. And so once the players arrive, they present, you know, opportunities to either of those figures. And either, you know, if the players take out one or go after one, then that, you know, gives the other one a chance to move and maybe bump off some of the rival's cult friends or, you know, neither of them is willing to sacrifice the PCs until a larger ritual happens because they both want to be there because they both want to take some advantage from it. So that's one, you know, place where we are, you know, that's one way you can use the cult, you know, the natural sort of fault line between native born Egyptians versus, you know, sort of hangers on or hanger on Brits.
Well, certainly that's how the that's how the Cult of the Black Pharaoh will see these pasty faced, you know, Celts and Angles and Jutes and Saxons who are glomming onto their cult as Johnny Con Lately wannabes who just presume by dint of their imperialness and their empire that somehow they're supposed to be fucking in charge.
Yeah, and whereas that, you know, Gavagan is, you know, he's all the vices of the British Empire. With magic.
I read that while running London and used that advice it became a factor in the game. It was actually very helpful. So I do want to say, so thank you for writing that. That was actually a really great.
I wanted to go on to this thing where, you know, we marked on our show notes some of Brett's favorite bits. I wanted to mark one of the ones right at the top, the 1925 January 24th New York eclipse that just happens to cover Harlem.
Yep.
I cannot believe that was not in the original book.
Well, that was someone on YoggSothoth.com actually just sort of dropped it one day, and we were talking about, you know, articles for the companion. Like, you know, there's an eclipse in January that year, right? And I went, no.
And it's like, how could this not be? The whole eclipse thing becomes this great telegraph of the whole plot.
I know, you know, it's awesome.
and it's right there, and we didn't even know. I only found out because I was doing I was going through a NASA site about eclipses, and there's actually a site that shows you can see every eclipse that ever was, and I was just going to put an eclipse in a scenario, and I'm farting around, and all of a sudden I see, wait a minute, January 1925 over the East Coast? What is that? You know? Could not believe that this was something that was left out, and it is one of the, it is a perfect gem for the campaign. So anyways, other things, what other things you mentioned in the show notes, your faves, I was hoping I'd get you to comment on it with a minimum amount of interruption from me.
There's a lot I like. I tried to focus on the stuff I didn't write, because I don't want to seem narcissistic. but, you know, I think the chapter that Anthony Warren did for Shanghai is true. It's like basically a Shanghai source book.
Call of Cthulhu. It's very in-depth.
It's outstanding. You know, I honestly suggested if, you know, he might still look into splitting that off as a book when it seemed like we wouldn't be able to publish this at all. But it's truly outstanding. I think it presents Shanghai. I mean, the game does an okay job, but I really, when I ran it the first time, I just did not understand extraterritoriality or, you know, how there was this international enclave or really even what the political situation in China is, which makes for a much stronger game because it's such a bizarre mess of jurisdictions and international residents who have a lot of, you know, rights versus the local Chinese who don't. And you can play that into the bloated woman cult certainly can be seen as a, you know, among other things, a sort of nationalistic organization, even if it's also a malign mythos cult. You know, you can, it's, well, still informed by the environment it's in.
That one throwaway line about Lin Tang Yu's brother or something is a warlord, you know, and it's just a one throwaway line in the book, but then, you know, you start doing research on what the implication is to being related to a warlord. Yep. And holy crap, if you think you're in trouble for punching the bloated woman cultists in the face, getting on the wrong side of a warlord's brother is going to be awful.
And it's such a divide for the players, you know, because you can wholesale practically slaughter some people in Shanghai without any repercussion at all. You dump the body in the street and no one cares, which is very different than London. But if you tick off the wrong local official, or, you know, Lin Tang Yu calls up his apparently ancient brother because he's like 130 himself. You know, you can be in a tremendous amount of danger suddenly, and you, especially with characters who become very used to the privilege that, you know, being a rich European or, you know, American in Shanghai in 1925 might provide. You know, it's certainly a nasty turn there. But yeah, I think that the Shanghai section, that we also added a piece on Hong Kong in large part because my players insisted on going there.
Yeah.
And I had no idea what Hong Kong was like in 1925, and it was not easy to find information in a sort of proto-internet era. I hopped on Alta Vista and fired up my Mosaic browser and didn't find too much. But
wow.
Well, yeah. I think it was a little post. It was like 96 when I ran it, I think. So it was post Mosaic, but a little, you know, I think it was Alta Vista I used. You know, the Jackson Elias chapter, I think, was critical because it's, you know, the one page handout, what you know about your friend Jackson Elias, often doesn't cut it for some players, especially.
Yeah, it's tough to get them to buy into that. That's your motivation. This is it. One page.
It's not just the idea of introducing it before the campaign starts is fun. You know, I think a fundamental thing if you have the time. But even if you don't, we offer some tips on how to, you know, keep him relevant as the game goes on. You know, I know that Matthew Pook tried to incorporate some Jackson Elias connection into the, you know, score plus NPCs he made or pre-generated characters he made.
Yeah.
But when it comes to, you know, like ideas like, you know, if the players are up a creek and they're stuck somewhere, you know, if they remember to check out, you know, try to figure out which hotel Elias was at, they could say, you know, he left a letter behind for himself, or he tried to mail something back to, you know, Prospero Press back in New York, and it never, you know, it was postage returned, or, you know, it ended up under an ash can, or you have those sorts of things, or, you know, there's something about having a seance. Because there's a medium in the game already. You can literally contact the spirits of the dead, and my players decided to use Agatha Broadmoor to do so, which was a really hard thing to figure out.
Well, if she's genuinely got the power, then, which is demonstrated by the scenario, if they save her, you know, then the implication is that she can short circuit the whole freaking thing by whistling up Jackson.
Yeah, I mean, at that point they knew most of what he already knew, so it wasn't a big deal. I think I had him being ravening and insane, but still throw out a couple useful clues. But yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of sort of problems that he presents.
You can also have Narlathotep stomp that shit. Right in the middle. Not in a big monster kind of way, but since it's on the spiritual plane.
Yeah.
Have him be able to shut that down.
I mean, I drew heavily from the seance section of
on the medium.
The what?
I'm sorry, I was saying there are all kinds of things that can speak through a medium once she decides to start let herself be haunted.
I think I ripped off heavily from the using the Paul LeMond character from Day of the Beast I think there's a whole little appendix on what you if he tries to contact Nefren Ka or something. I ripped that off wholesale. Mm-hmm. When I ran it, but
The Nefren Ka possession scene from Day of the Beast is actually one of the best things in the whole campaign.
And I happily borrowed it.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things about masks. It's like a black hole. It'll pull in other games.
Yes. And we have suggestions in each chapter on if you for some reason want to make it even longer, there are other scenarios you can wrap in and add in as either sidelights or, you know, what you can try to integrate them into the main plot.
Oh, the skinless one cultists are the ones that I want to throw in. So when the players are in transit around the world, the mythos assassins who show up are all those skinless one cultists who are wearing different faces and different appearances, you know, to make a run at them on the boat and then switch their face so they look like somebody else, you know. You just find a discarded face on the deck. You know, that's
kind of,
you know, exactly. Face off. so let me ask you. All right. So one of the things that always got me when I was doing research for a computer game about they were going to do some pulp stuff and they were going to set it in Cairo. And I started looking up Cairo in the 20s and 30s. Well, really the 30s. But one of the things that I ran across is that right after there was a British general who was assassinated in Cairo. He was like the governor general of Anglo-Egyptian Sudan. And it happened in like 1925 or 1924. One of the things I ran across was that, you know, and it's an important question for players, it was actually easier to get a license to carry a gun in Egypt as a foreigner in 1925 than it was to get a gun if you were a local.
Well, certainly. I mean, you can trust those nice foreign types.
But there was all these riots that were going on, and attacks on foreigners in 1925 were through the roof because the British were just finally transitioning because they'd taken over Egypt in World War I. Oh, just for your security, we're just protecting the canal. And then the war's over, and they didn't give it back. They didn't return it to Egyptian control until, I think, like 1925. So when you get to Cairo, it's the land of riots and people throwing rocks at foreigners, and foreigners are on everybody's shit list. So you actually turn up and you can get tooled up with iron pretty quickly, but it's a detail, of course, that's left out of, you know, Mass, that there's riots in the streets, that Cairo is in chaos. And then
you can include that stuff to complicate the campaign if you want. I mean, you can make it sort of an Agatha Christie, you know, everyone take a trip down the Nile game if you want, or you can have full scale historic riots going on at the same time. I mean, even, you know, I think was it 26 London had its own riots. So,
well, that's awesome, because here are all these little previews of what Nyarlathotep has in mind for us. The kind of chaos and bloodshed, and, you know, having the players get little snippets of that in places like Cairo and Shanghai, and if there was some way to find out if find a nice labor riot in England during 1925, that would be even better, you know.
You've got to wait 26 for the Great Strike, I think. So
yeah.
You know, it's interesting. One of my players in my current group is a postdoc history, you know, finishing up his PhD in history. And so he knows a lot about the history, especially the early 20th century. And he made a point, you know, there was actually a point I got, like, that we sort of debated on in the Kenya chapter, where this is a suggestion I took from the Mask's Companion, where, like, as the players are going to the mountain, they're on safari, basically, and they see one of the encounters that the companion suggests is that they run into basically slavers who are taking a group of people up to be sacrificed. And that I had the character, one character, make a knowledge check or spend a point to, like, realize, wait, that in Kenya here now? No, there shouldn't be people in manacles going up. This doesn't make sense. And the player's like, wait. And I said, oh, the British have gotten rid of slavery. And like, what? Well, the reality is more complex. And so we went back and forth. And what he basically, talking about it, he made the point that, well, when Masks was written in 1984, the history books that would have been available to Larry DiTilio were not as good as they are now. And so, like, the kind of information he would get about what was life like in Kenya in 1925 would not have been as accurate as the books we have now, as the kind of information, or Cairo or anything else.
Sure.
So DiTilio might not have been able to know about those riots, because he might not have had a book that explained the riots in Cairo very accurately, or, you know, that kind of information might have been buried in 1984 or 1983, I guess, when he was writing it. So that's something to keep in mind. Like,
it's, well, true.
One of the challenges of Masks is that you're a specific historical point in time, and there's a lot of information that's now available that's not really goes over in the book.
Yeah.
You know, like, I really enjoy how the Masks Companion, like, says, here's how you get around. Here's the currency. Here's the laws on guns, for every single area.
And the laws on guns are critical for players. Everybody wants to know, what weapon am I going to be able to have in London? The answer, not much.
Well, you have all these damn cultists coming out of the woodwork to assassinate you just because you keep asking people about Jackson Elias.
Yeah.
Well, but at least they all conveniently carry their team weapons, so it's always helpful to, you know, exactly who the cultists are, because they have their ritual sacrifice weapons.
Right, the Pranga.
Yeah, Pranga blades everywhere.
Right. Yeah.
They're like blaster rifles for stormtroopers.
The spiked club of the Dark Pharaoh. That's the one that always gets me. I got a question for because I have not finished. It's only 600 pages, so I haven't finished reading the companion. But one of my biggest gripes has always been things like, how am I going to? Here's something that I, as a keeper, have to fix, because it's not working for me, is the Mountain of the Black Wind cultist hoedown.
Mm-hmm.
The description is, there's 10,000 cultists.
I think that's the chapter title, too.
Yeah. You get to the Mountain of the Black Winds, and it's just this, you know, it's literally described as it's like 10,000 cultists, this giant, you know, Lenny Riefenstahl-sized Triumph of the Will, except for Nyarlathotep. Othotep. And, you know, you know, it's like, okay, how the fuck did these people all just get to Kenya? You know, which into this isolated place, the players are hiking out there at a safari. Does this mean that tens of thousands of cultists have been moving through Nairobi, you know, and buying up all the expedition supplies so they can hike out into the Kenyan wilderness? You know, how are they getting there?
I'm assuming most are relatively local, but I always kind of had a Gunga Din feeling from that sequence.
How do you mean Gunga Din?
Well, you know, when they sort of arrive at the 30s version, they arrive at the, what, Kali Temple and get the kill for love of killing speech. You know, I think they've been sort of moving there. I mean, yeah, I think one of the suggestions we have is encountering a band of, you know, cultists moving toward the mountain, but which is, you know, sort of blend in Lord of the Rings style. Let's put on some orc armor and approach.
Yeah, that worked out so well for Conan in the first Conan movie. You know, just put on the robes and just, you know. It'll be
giant medallion and all.
Yeah, exactly. You know?
I mean, that's what I kind of did, and I had the players, like, as they got closer to the mountain wind, they had to avoid more and more of these guys on pilgrimage. But I also had a lot of the European and the foreign cultists who were showing up for the ceremony, getting there through gate spells, basically. That they would just pop a gate a couple miles away walk in.
There's going to be the class difference between the guys who are hoofing it and the guys who are winging in on air bayaki and just being dropped off. That's actually kind of cool to demonstrate that.
It's just like Gen Con.
Yeah. to see assholes turning up, you know, with clothing from South America, or you know, dressed like a Mexican don or a Russian, you know, some czarist or something like that, or, you know, Mongolian finery, having all those guys show up, you know, via gates and things like that, that, you know, that's the kind of thing that lets the players go, oh fuck, even though we're gonna go to, you know, Shanghai and Australia and all these other places, that's not gonna fix this, you know.
Yeah.
It's so much bigger.
Hypothetically, you could just give up at that point, because, I mean, you can try to interrupt the ritual there and stop the spawn from being born, but you know, it's not critical. I think I'm trying to remember, my players actually snuck in, like mixed in with the cultists and set some dynamite and left before they actually ran into anybody, because they were playing pretty paranoid at that point.
The thing is, and this is sort of one of the pitfalls of Masks, is that the players can only figure out what the real plot is and what the real objectives are in like two or three specific places. And those are later on. And so in both times I've run it, and I just finished the Kenya chapter, including the mountain, the players see this and they don't know that this isn't that this is sort of a redundant ceremony, that this is not going to knock them out. And so they're like, we're in it to win it. And so the first time I ran it, it was a near or total TPK.
Because they treated it like it was the end of the road.
Yeah, they did, because it certainly looks like it. And some player humped in a Maxim machine gun and made a last stand, while the other players threw dynamite left and right and whatnot. And then that was years and years ago. This time, they had a patron in the form of the Yithians, who have just been using the players as cat's paws, because the Yithians want them, you know, for obvious purposes later on. But the Yithians gave them basically one advantage, and then they could. I said that they could, because I foresaw this TPK coming if I didn't do anything. And so I gave the players a brief advantage where they could, like, basically gate out, or it would freeze time and they could gate out. So I figured they might, if they did anything other than escape, they would get some advantage, but then they're basically SOL. And so some players decided to, like, I will charge the, you know, the spawn with dynamite. That's fine for my character. And then, on and on and on. And it was a very dramatic thing, but then I said, yep, you're not over yet. You didn't stop them.
Yeah. That's what happened with the Gaming Grunts, real play or actual playthrough. They sort of assumed it was the end of the campaign and charged, Light Brigade style into their deaths.
That's really interesting, because there, you know, there are literally three of those. There are three presentations: Cairo, Kenya, and Shanghai that all look like they're the climax, but only one of them really is. Only one of them actually brings the whole plot, the whole machination of Narlathotep to a close. But you can get players, you know, and they are absolutely, every one of them are giant James Bondian volcano-based sequences.
Yes. Literally.
You know? Too literally, and actually. The thing is, if you reread the opening notes of Masks, it says it specifically addresses dealing with Ginyu. Like, okay, well, if you take out the spawn, then another sort, and Ryu, then Omar Shakti could take over for their role in the ceremony. So you have it, you know, hurts them, but it doesn't stop them. So it specifically addresses that.
How important is it to find ways to communicate that to the players?
Well, one of the things I tried to add in the companion was a section on having the characters have sort of prophetic dreams or visions, because both Jackson Elias and Roger Carlyle complained about dreams. Mm-hmm. So I sort of threw in a bunch of, you know, relatively informative visions that would, you could either see events before they happened, or sort of nightmares that would give you an idea of the scope of, you know, Nyarlathotep's cult. And, you know, sort of, you were talking about the where the plot is explained. Yeah, there are only really two or three plot points where you can really figure out what's going on, other than there are some cults and they're bad. So I tried to expand that those options. You know,
one thing I did, taking from, I think it's one of the suggestions in the book, is also in London, the Mr. Shipley and his paintings. And one of the players actually, you know, this is one of the death traps. This is one of the things. The way it's written in Mass and Nyarlathotep, if a player looks at one specific painting, they're gone forever.
It's the Sphere of Annihilation from.
Yeah. Yeah. But I get. But because of it, I realized this could be a way to get in some more exposition in a way that's organic to the campaign and also put some danger. So one player went in the painting, but he showed up in a little place that's described in the painting is in the distant past with the serpent people. And the serpent people... So while the players were trying to figure out, I told the other players, okay, you spend your Cthulhu Mythos skill, you realize if you can get the painting back, there might be a way to pull them back. But you have to go get the painting really quickly. And so while they're rushing that, it's like, all right, the serpent people capture you, and they're like, you're totally harmless to them, so they'll answer your questions because they don't give a shit. And so the serpent people are like, yeah, we're waiting to go to your time. Has your time screwed up yet? I mean, we're waiting for the Empire of Humanity to fall, because that's going to happen real soon. and so he like realizes that, and through that they realize that that's the ultimate goal of the cults of Nyarlathotep, is the ending of the Empire of Humanity. You know, that all civilization will fall, and it would be bad times for everyone. Well, and so that was my opportunity to put that information in there, so they realized what the stakes were.
That gave you a chance to get the Yithians in, because the Yithians have to keep us on course for the doom that they need for their future.
Exactly. And plus they need a favor in the immediate future, because, you know, in Australia, they kind of want some help there. So that's how I framed it. But I have been using some of the dreams too. The dreams also work really well, because there's several times in the campaign for visions. Like there's the incense cones that Mr. Singh has in Kenya. And if you use those, well, hey, those dreams work as visions, you know?
Yeah.
Now Singh's the tea shop owner in London, right?
No,
he's in Kenya. That's
Tandor Singh.
Yeah, there's two tea shop owners, actually, and he's the one in Nairobi.
Pretty much anyone who has a retail establishment is a fucking cultist. And if you've got a shop, you're gonna you should just proceed. You know, there's that little ring as the bell on the door opens, and then you just throw a hand grenade in. You know,
it's really the anti-capitalist ideology of Mass Annihilation is quite insidious, I have to say.
it's all very down on the small businessman. from the juju shop to the tea shop to...
Oh, yeah, the juju shop. You know, my players have been so terrified. In both campaigns so far, they're like, no, we're not going.
No, I'm not
even going to go near that.
I think it was the gaming grunts who had the thing where they ran into the manager of the docks in New York City... Who's talking about the Kenyan I guess he's Kenyan chief cultist in New York, the high priest, I can't remember the name of the guy at the docks, but he's just this standard New York blue collar, that fucking darky, that nigger, and he just starts going off on this fucking racist invective, and the players immediately went, oh. Well, clearly, because he's a racist, the dock owner must be the bad guy, must be the cultist, and the guy he's being racist to must be okay. Mm-hmm. And it completely derailed the players for a while, just because they were not prepared for their keeper dumping some of that 1920s nasty right in their laps. And that's another question about the companion. I've only read through an earlier version. I didn't get even a chance to look at the 600-page one. And I do not remember if you addressed some of the standard Call of Cthulhu. Okay, it's the 1920s. This is the age of open sexism and racism and colonial bigotry, you know.
I mean, there's certainly points where it's discussed. I mean, especially, you know, the options for... I mean, we talk a bit about having, you know, how the background of a character may, especially I think the character creation notes, recommendations that we have from Matthew Pook, some characters will be at an advantage in some locations and a disadvantage in others. I certainly, when we sort of wrote up notes for the small crawler cult, I tried to invert the normal sort of suave, you know, white guy in charge of a bunch of, you know, swarthy lunatics. Ideas. It's in there. It's discussed. We don't highlight it, but we certainly don't shy away from acknowledging the sort of sometimes problematic racial issues of the game. I think, at least, especially when it comes to these cults.
Certainly, it has that. It does have that kind of standard pulp nonsense that you'd expect from Robert E. Howard or somebody writing in that, where there are a lot of again, suave white guy. But you know what? In some ways, except for that's really not the case in Kenya. It's not the case in Cairo. It's not the case in Hong Kong, no matter what's his name on Black Dragon Island thinks. It's really Ho Fong who's calling the shots there. And I love the idea of the tension between Gavigan and, since it's not Tandor Singh, I've suddenly forgotten the name. Tufik. Al Sayed, yeah. I love the idea that colonialism versus, colonizer versus colonized tension between where despite the fact we're worshiping alien gods from beyond time and space, we're bringing all of the tensions and bigotry and baggage of the material world with us. You know what I mean? And they're going to see there's going to be competitions inside the cult.
Have to come from somewhere. They don't just sort of emerge from the earth wholesale. Yeah. They come from societies and cultures, and they bring their, prejudices with them. So that's an easy point to make.
Those prejudices may be key motivators as well.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And, I think I was happy to have, suggest that Omar Shakti was responsible for these tensions, because what the best way to stay the immortal head of a cult is to have all of your underlings trying to murder each other. Because they're too busy to murder you.
Yeah. That's a lesson that's been taught by any number of dictators over the years.
I think it's valuable with this campaign, kind of especially, but with any role-playing game that is not just a pure fantasy, it's pretty valuable to have kind of a foundational meeting with the players and the game master at the outset to just sort of say, here's some issues that we're likely to delve into that may be tricky. So let's make sure that this isn't going to be a hand grenade that's going to ruin friendships.
I definitely advise in any game, and I think we explicitly say in the notes, is the best way to have a fun game is to know what your players are expecting. Do they want to have two-fisted pulp action, or are they looking for, sort of a 20s James Bond, or they look what you know what their expectations are should influence how the game is run. If you want to run a spy versus spy sort of anti cult adventures, but your players want to knock down every door and fire roll a grenade in, then you got some problems. So it's best to get those expectations, but also to talk about what they're looking for in the game, so try to match that as much as you can.
Yeah. Yeah, you want to know your players and your GM. So when you do run into those scenes of horrible racist invective, then players know that's not the GM sort of maliciously channeling some kind of wish fulfillment scene.
Yeah, I mean, I'm all for historical realism, but I really don't need to sit around the table and have players try to remember, what did my grandma call, people?
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh, that's painful.
Yeah. So we should probably move on to other things because my time draws shorter.
Okay.
I have one other question for Brett. And that is one of the classic scenes of Masks. And again, I haven't read your treatment in the companion, but one of the classic scenes in Masks is the confrontation under the bent pyramid.
Yes.
And it's really critical because, again, it turns into TPKs because every player thinks, it's Nyarlathotep. How many hit points does he have? And then you have a big pile of dead players. And so my question was, were there any interesting spins you put on it? How did you address the gate to the past? That's always something that's kind of seemed very weird.
Do you mean the rites under the Sphinx, or when you go? Oh, you mean when they go into the bent pyramid, chit chat with Nyarlathotep?
When you chit chat with Nyarlathotep, okay. And he throws open the damn gate to the past. He tries to dissuade them from, from continuing their work or continuing the quest, and then he opens his gate to the past as if they're going to be stupid enough to poke their nose into it. And I've never understood, why do you open the gate? It's like, if the players step through, well, why would they?
I think that was a way of the author sort of telegraphing his power, because, sort of instantaneous time travel at will is not the typical power of even the scariest of human magicians. We definitely stress that as a critical sequence in the game. And we try to, talk. I recommend everyone read the sort of confrontation between Randolph Carter and Nyarlathotep in the Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath, because I really think that's the scene that probably inspired that sequence.
I think to determine
what Nyarlathotep wants out of that encounter, because he doesn't need to talk to the players or the characters at all. I think, if I recall, it's been a while since I wrote it, talk about how, is he actually trying to dissuade them from their expedition? Or, is he doing it just because he's bored? Or is he using them as a scourge for his cultists because they've been lazy and disorganized? What does he actually desire to get out of this confrontation? He's just like, seeing humans kill each other. Because otherwise, there's no motivation for him to have. He's not literally scared of the players. There's no. This is a chance for him to have some fun. But what's he doing? That's the question the keeper has to decide.
Certainly, if I remember correctly, I want to say that it's actually the players actually summon him by lighting the fires.
They wander into the bent pyramid for because they know something happened here. They know this is where the Carlisle expedition went in and came back changed. Yes. And they're trying to figure out why. I think once they enter the chamber, it just sort of happens on its own.
I think you're right. I think the door slams and it's like an instant funhouse. Yeah.
Yeah. Gem like braziers start to light up and everything happens. My players, one of them died because they decided to shoot him in the face when I played it. And that when he was horrible, I just simply said, "You die." And there wasn't any die rolls, and everyone else got really quiet. He's like, "What do you mean I die?" Like, "Well, your gun dissolves into dust, and then, you look down your hand just vanishing like the wind's blowing away your fingers, and you try to take a step, and you fall into ash, and then you're dead." But that was an effective method of getting everyone to stop and listen.
And let me tell you, that's a lot more effective than invisible hunting horrors, which never worked for me. It's Nyarlathotep. He doesn't need bodyguards.
Yeah, I think I was nice enough to let the guy wake up in a ditch in Cairo later, but be changed in some horrible way. But yeah, it was a Yeah, I mean, that sequence is a critical encounter. I mean, just because it also is a way to reveal the, you know, the 3 points of summoning and all of the ritual sites, and it's a big info dump, but it's also a great sort of role-playing opportunity. And
there is a map showing the critical areas.
Yeah, so why is why is he showing off where this is happening, other than he wants you to go there and mess it up?
Yeah. Otherwise, he squashes you all like bugs. You know.
Yeah.
Your options are sealed inside the. I mean, he does leave you sealed inside the tomb, and the only way to get you out is to have players on the outside dig you out.
I think you can push your way out too, but yeah, it's not a fun time.
Or you go through the gate into the past. I always had the gate in the. I always wanted the gate in the past to be like Gnarlthwip saying, "Here's your way out. Humanity's going to be gone next year, but here's your way out. I'm you're amusing, and I like you guys. You're really cute. Why don't you just go through this gate into the past, and you can live out your lives in relative safety, and so can your children, and your children's children, and your children's children's children, right?
Yeah."
You know, it'll be a whole new future for you in the past.
It's a consolation prize.
You know, but you don't want to be around here next year. It's going to be ugly for you. So why don't you just go in the past? This is my gift to you. See? You know, the messenger of the outer gods knows some mercy or something, you know, try and con them into stepping out. Who knows what's on the other side? Some people suggest that you go into the past and it's Egypt during the reign of the Black Pharaoh. And when you arrive, you're just immediately sacrificed in some horrible, horrible manner. Or, you know, the palace guards are out to skin you alive or something. But anyways, anything else you wanted to throw out from...
I think the one other element that I put in because of... it's sort of a response to my campaign was... I tried to make the tomes more that just show up everywhere more integral to the campaign by providing a lot more information on them. And what they, I mean, the problems are you get these books, the players assume they're important because they were hard to get and they give you Cthulhu Mythos points. And my players just spent weeks and characters with the sacrifice, you know, were out of play for weeks and weeks because they were studying, you know, fragments of the Book of Ibon. And at the end, I'm like, well, you get 6 points of Cthulhu Mythos and you learn a couple of really useless spells. What? What's the point of that? So I tried to figure out, you know, like why I try to either make them helpful in some way. Like if you get a book, there should be some purpose to it. You know, the My Life as a God tells you all about the cult of the Black Pharaoh. That's actually useful. But the campaign itself sort of says it's the ravenings of a madman. And that's, you know, you get one handout, and that's pretty useless for a 4-week study period or something. Yeah, so I try to integrate them more, you know, into the narrative
as artifacts. It really ought to have things in it like how to get into the Bent Pyramid, how to get under the Sphinx. It should have that kind of crap in it, you know.
And we included some notes on that, I think.
Yeah, and as we've discussed, that this is a campaign that has a couple of kind of choke points in terms of the information that you can get. So if you've got the tomes sound like potential, I mean, do you kind of go into using them as sources of those clues, of those information?
I don't think explicitly, but I think in the discussion of the tomes with their contents, you know, it's I think some of them are more useful than others just directly. Like I know the My Life as a God is definitely like, you know, it tells you, you know, if you see the, you know, weapon, the ritual sacrifice thing of the Black Pharaoh, you know it immediately. You know, it also gives you insight into, like, you know, they have their sacrifices on the new moon, and you know, provides information on the cult in general. I think some of the other books are useful.
Goddess of the Black Fan should give you, you know, you should learn the cult symbol. You should know what the cult tattoo is if you've read Goddess of the Black Fan and My Life as a God. You should be looking for the, you know, the Ankh, the broken Ankh, and the,
you know. Yes, exactly. You know, it should give you some insight into how the cult operates, what, you know, maybe a better idea of who it is. I think, I mean, we have some, I think we have implicit comments on that, and some of the, we have quotes from every tome that you can hand out so the players know what the heck they're reading. Because my players, you know, I think it was the Panonic manuscript. I had no idea what it was. I looked it up in the Call of Cthulhu rules. I said, it's a book about the history of the world. Like, okay, what's it say? I'm like, there were aliens, and that was terrible. It was a point where they really lost the players, and so I wanted to, you know, make it, you know, why did Carlyle get these books? Why was he interested in them? You know, what was he trying to learn? Well, you know, there are clues in the Panonic manuscript to where, you know, where Huston ends up. And there's My Life as a God teaches you about the Black Pharaoh cult. And, you know, there's all sorts of, we tried to make them more integral plot-wise into the game itself. So I think that was something I was happy with. And, you know, a couple of them, I think especially the Seven Cryptical Books of Hassan, which was also, I think Anthony Warren made that up, was probably my favorite of all of the tome write-ups, because he proposed that it could be read as a text in Chinese, could be read in any direction. And it was there effectively an infinite mythos tome. Every time you read it, you had the same mythos points and the same sanity loss, and you got totally new information, which is why everyone's after it, because it's, you know, effectively, if you read it, you know, if you skip every third letter, if you skip from, you know, every fifth letter character, it's a different tome. And it's a sort of impossible dreamlands artifact of absolute nightmare that'll teach you anything you want to know at a horrendous, horrendous price.
Yeah.
Nice work.
It was brilliant. When I got that in the mail, I immediately emailed him back with, like, you know, said I am standing and clapping. It was great.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, but all of them just make them work better, I hope.
Yeah.
So another, I guess the last big, apart from the fact that you've got so much information that you want to convey and you've got to come up with to do that, the last sort of big challenge, which we may have addressed a little bit already, but is just the physical lethality of masks, for which it's infamous, and we all have hilarious stories about it. But it can be a real challenge to play, you know, and to either as the GM to kind of, you know, find ways to soft pedal it so that you're not slaughtering characters left and right and just cheat on their behalf, or else don't and find these really inventive ways to keep bringing replacement characters in. And the danger, there are pitfalls in both of those approaches, because on the one hand, of course, you don't want to let on that you're helping the players out, right, so much that it reduces their suspense. But on the other hand, if they're just losing characters left and right, they can become disinterested, you know, and they can lose their investment in the campaign.
Yeah. And you run out of people who knew Jackson Elias at some point.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'm always kind of curious to hear people's approaches to those sort of conflicting challenges.
Well,
I think if you're running it, the first thing you have to do is figure out what your framing device is for the characters. And that's obviously the Friends of Jackson Elias is the start, but you have to think of beforehand of like what the mechanism is for introducing new characters. And in my, like in the first campaign I ran, literally on, actually the serpent person in London became a patron of the group. Cause I decided in that version, he was just going to like, no, I don't like the cult of Nyarlathotep. Oh, here's some human pawns. Go and fight them. My minions. And, in the campaign version I'm running now, it's the Yithians for similar but different reasons. Not entirely the same reasons. So that's the first thing, is to introduce a mechanism that makes sense for the story for new characters to show up. Because eventually, you'll run out of people who've actually met Jackson Elias. Yeah. The other thing is just, I think, how you approach these, you know, paintings, Tomb of Horror, Death Trap situations, and how the players approach them. But
in the companion itself, we offer, you know, a section on, you know, what we call tentpole NPCs who can be used to sort of be a patron for, you know, the group. And there are a bunch of options ranging in, you know, useful abilities from, what's his name? The editor of Prospero Press, whose name I'm...
Jonah Kensington, I think.
You know, from the obvious ones like Jonah Kensington to, you know, much less obvious ones like the serpent person in London, or, you know, old Bundari potentially for all sakes and purposes, or Johnstone Kenyatta, who could keep, you know, sort of either, you know, help introduce a new character or two if you have a small loss, or if necessary, you know, we have some notes on how to deal with the TPK, is either, you know, they say, well, here, you know, the one survivor, and here are some stalwart young men I met who want to go die with you. Or, you know, even one suggestion we have is just reboot it and set it during the early, late 30s and say, you know, like, a group of heroes died trying to stop this horrible thing and they failed. You must undo their damage.
But there's certainly a lot of resources inside the campaign that, but I don't feel like they're, except in the case of Shanghai, they're not really explicitly, in a lot of ways, they're not explicitly spelled out as things that are going to help, except for the new China movement.
the fascist Chinese who come to your aid, yeah. I mean, you know, I think it sort of boils down to a combination of a play style. I mean, if you have a group of conservative, careful players who I guess Jim Rockford did, as you said, you know, the fatality rate is much lower than the people who walk in to say, you know, hello, Mr. Gavigan, here are all the artifacts we've recovered. Can you please help me translate this book I found?
Yeah.
Sure, of course. Come to my estate. Don't tell anyone.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that I think there are points we suggest simply changing the you know, the monsters. I mean, you know, when you don't need to have 9 servitors of the outer gods appear at a ritual. You can, is more than enough.
Exactly. When it's bulletproof and it's immune to all physical damage, you're good.
Yeah. You know, if you under the pyramids, you know, it's dark and narrow. You can, you know, if one character falls and gets eaten by the Children of the Sphinx, you know, that then they can escape, you know, have there be a cost, but not necessarily make it, you know, a total part, unless, you know, give them an, I always, my goal is generally to say, like, are you sure you want to do that? Which is generally a sign to my players that that's a terrible idea.
Yeah.
That someone's going to die. But I mean, you know, at the same time, if you want to run a, you know, high lethality campaign, then you can have a framing NPC or, you know, your Gilchrist Trust or whatever it is backing them up, or, you know, you know, Erica Carlisle is sending an endless wave of former French Foreign Legion soldiers to investigate her brother's disappearance.
Well, that's funny. You bring up Erica, and Erica's one of the. It is actually in the rules. It's like you must crit a fast talk. It's like really difficult to get her to cooperate in the rules. But I always thought she made the perfect, you know, sort of base, you know, home base character, because there's that suggestion you should have a. I think the book says something like, one of the players should stay in America and collate all the information being sent back. And I'm like, you mean one of the player characters should not play the game?
Well, you're probably someone who gets crippled falling off of a fire escape.
But I think also, remember back in the early 80s, back in that era, a lot of games, especially in D&D, people ran multiple characters at a time. Like your backup character. Is the clerk. So if your primary character dies, you can ship in the clerk.
But but Carlisle always struck me as the perfect, you know, person to fill that role, especially because for me, she was always she was always untrustworthy because she has another agenda. Her brother needs to be dead so that she can control the family fortune.
Yes. Well, and I mean, we suggest, you know, that if Carlisle doesn't back you, her assistant Bradley Gray could always covertly do it.
Yeah,
without telling,
to keep you safe, and he proceeds to keep you safe the way that Robert Shaw keeps James Bond safe all through, you know, Russia with Love. Only at the end, if you get to Hong Kong, the first thing he does is shoot Carlisle in the head. If you actually find him, you know, in his madhouse in Hong Kong, it turns out your patron was only there to make sure that Carlisle dies so that her inheritance is good, and then suddenly you jerk all the money out from under them, where suddenly there's no more checks coming. There's no more postal money orders from, you know, from Manhattan coming. And you're suddenly, you know, it changes the, you know, it would, you know, but wait, the whole fate of the world is at stake. Yeah, whatever. My fortune's secure. Bye-bye. You know, and suddenly, you know, they're not quite the patron you thought they were. Carlisle always seemed like a great setup for that.
I think she is.
And it's a shame that it's not more explicitly spelled out. But, you know, the big thing about Masks is it's a giant book of hints. Nothing is really complete, is it? I mean, it's all just, you know, you think it's complete, but when you actually read it, it's just a huge compilation of suggestions and hints and inspirations. It's almost nothing is really complete, except maybe for the, you know, maps. Oh my God, there are a lot of maps.
Yeah.
Well, which is one of the, you know, that's one of the things that makes it great is it's sandboxy, both in the fact that it's not this linear thing where you're going straight from this adventure to specifically that adventure, but it's kind of built to be a campaign framework that you can build a lot of different experiences around. And
I think the best piece of advice we have in the whole book is just, you know, make it your own campaign. You don't feel bound by anything in there. It's not, you know, this isn't a computer program and you're not a computer. You're someone telling a story. Tell the story you want to tell. Take the parts you want to take and do whatever. I mean, you know, people sort of balk at the size of the companion. Dear God, don't read it all in one sitting. And please don't use every single thing we mentioned because you'll never be finished. But take what you want. Combine it in a way that's
definitely
useful to
you. Definitely what I'm doing with my current run is, like, I have pulled material from Trail of Cthulhu, Stunning Eldritch Tales, Call of Cthulhu, you know, Fearful Passages, Cthulhu Casebook, Shadows of Yogg-Sothoth, The Mask's Companion, some of my own materials, The Sense of the Sleight of Hand Man. It just goes on and on. It's becoming this Frankenstein kind of beast that is not a purist run, but everyone's having a fun. And, you know, the main thing is a lot of cultists are getting shot up. So, you know, that's the the real joy.
All right. Let us wrap things up here because we've been on for a while. And
long while.
Yeah. And, and
it's a long campaign.
Brett, thank you so much for joining us and talking about the Masks Companion. So
the Kickstarter is still running, is at least another 9 days.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, there's a Kickstarter for the Masks.
Holy shit!
Yeah, we should mention that. If you've not, hopped in, that's still open. I think from it closes on, as I open up the page, it's 9 days from when we're recording this, so I don't know when.
March the 9th. You know the end date?
March 10th. Tuesday, March 10th at 1:55 Eastern Time for some reason. I don't know what dark site that portends, but so March 10th, it'll close. So you can get a PDF copy for as little as £15. And then you can go up to, I think they sold out all of the hardback special edition versions, which I don't understand why people want, because all I want is a copy of the book. But people love collectibles, so we should have sold more, apparently.
Yeah.
But yeah, you can still get up to, I think, up to the hardback edition. So it's, I'm trying to see what the backer levels are. £15 for the PDF, $30 for the book, $50 for the hardback, it looks like pounds, and then the £65 Mueru's Groom editions are all gone. But, you know, if you run into me somewhere, I'll be happy to sign it no matter what version you buy.
Yeah.
Sign my PDF.
Excellent.
So yeah, it's out. There's a little extra content they're going to be adding in, not too much because we want to get this thing finally. I've been working on it since January of 2007. I want it out. I want it gone. I want it to be.
Yeah, I was looking at the version, the preview version that we have access to here, and I was. It occurred to me that it really needs to be fleshed out some.
Yeah.
We could add a couple more chapters.
I'm like, sure. Maybe someone else is welcome to do that.
Right.
Fair enough.
Awesome.
Fair enough.
Thank you very much, everybody. Well,
sure. Thanks for having me on. It's been great talking to you guys.
Okay.
This has been Unspeakable. The Unspeakable is produced by Ross Payton for the Unspeakable Oath. And as this episode's music is Nyarlathotep by the Darkest of the Hillside Thickets, courtesy Divine Industries, copyright 2014. Visit thickets.net. Neanderthal tale, separate you to help me, Neanderthal tale.